we have completed our social exchanges. We do have one or two late apologies. There was a time when I was in Gauteng, I used to say, after getting every kind of traffic excuse, that I was having everyone come in and check, the AAs check everyone's transport. But I realized that public transport can sometimes be a challenge. We've got a couple of late apologies. And one is from the Honourable Van Merwe, and the other one is from the Honourable Dr. Wilmot James, who will be arriving late, probably at 9. But thank you very much for being here earlier than we normally sit. But as we all know, this for us, we considered a very important part of the public hearings. And that was that we hear from the horse's mouth exactly what the issue is regarding Eskom, etc. So we, as has been indicated by members of Eskom in the past, senior members, the CEO, Dr. Brian Dalmers, was delayed in China on prior engagements and then at a board meeting, but has very kindly agreed to engage with us this morning and to do an extensive, an in-depth engagement. And I've agreed to that because this is important. You know, if you are going to adopt a critical mind on something, then you must ensure you have as many of the facts as possible from the source. And that is what we are about to do. But publicly, I also would like to thank our whip, the Honourable Vicky Khadebe, for chairing last week's meetings superbly, I understand, with everyone today in such a friendly mood because they weren't delayed at any point in time. So thank you very much, Honourable Khadebe, for that and to the committee. Thank you. So we're not going to move. I know we've got adoption of the agenda. Can we have a quick adoption of that, please? Yes, Honourable Hill Lewis and Honourable McIntosh. So whenever I come back, I have to work out which method it is. I am so sorry. 1 week away, my memory's gone. Thank you very much. Can we proceed then? We will conclude when we have concluded. Over immediately to yourself, CEO, Mr. Dalmers. I see from here you've got, I hope I'm correct now, is it Mr. Adam here, Divisional Executive, Regulation and Legal, Mr. Chue, right behind, yeah, Divisional Executive, Corporate Affairs, and Ms. Karen de Villa, Parliamentary Affairs Manager, Corporate Affairs, and then is it Mr. Paul O'Flaherty, Financial Director, yeah, it would give the Irish finances to manage, huh? Fine. Over to yourself, Mr. Thomas.
Thank you for the opportunity. And we've always believed that it's very important that we do attend all our engagements within Parliament. My apologies for not being here at the last opportunity if the committee has engaged with us. We have just an introduction. The team has handed out the booklets in front of you. I would not want that to distract you. It is our interim results we released yesterday. We thought it useful that the committee has that. It is both our integrated reports for 6 months as well as a presentation presented yesterday. Eskom decided 3 years ago that we also, like a listed company, would produce interim results that we ordered. And it's very important to ensure transparency. And so we've made that available for your information. It's a good reference as well as to how the current performance is actually going at Eskom. Chair, what we have done today is we have provided to the committee, to my understanding, you have raised some very specific questions in our last presentation. We've provided you a written response, and that's the essence of the discussion we're going to have this morning. I'm going to work through the document. I suggest we work through it page by page. And what we have done is we've added some additional slides to give greater clarity to some of the issues. So those are the slides that's on the screens. It's slightly bigger than what's in the document, but it allows us to have greater clarity. And we'll make sure that we'll again formally submit to the committee both these slides and this document, as well as any additional questions, Chair, that you have, so that eventually the committee has got a full response from ESCOM, both our original presentation, this question and answer, and then any additional questions that you have. So if you would allow us, Chair, if there's something that we cannot explain or deal with, we will come back to you in writing in that regard. Between myself, Paul, and Mohammed, we will go through the different sections of the actual document, Chair. So if you allow me, we then work through the document that we've put in, and I'm going to go through it. I think we can work through it page by page. And, Chair, I don't know if you would like me to finish every page and then ask questions, or should we just allow members to ask questions as we go along?
Probably it would be more constructive if you moved through. We are used to that. Perhaps at a suitable point you may find a halfway mark, but let's move on the basis. Are we all agreed? So I hope there's some clarity here. There will be one or two slides that you don't have, and these will be put on the screen. We will be getting them.
Chair, thank you. On page one of the document, the purpose really of the document is reflected in terms of our application submitted to NERSA. And I think it's very important that we know this is an application ESCOM has submitted. We will go through now a process of engagement, and so we're all busy with really engaging. So we welcome this engagement. We have gone out to the public of South Africa to actually urge Africans to engage with the application. So as we move towards early next year, NERSA can have all the input. The committee has raised a number of issues and requests towards ESCOM, and we have put our responses within this. As an executive summary, and just to recap, and I know we've gone through this, the current multi-year price determination process, MYPD2, ends in March 2013. And therefore, ESCOM now needs to submit an application to the National Energy Regulator, who will determine the country's electricity price adjustment for the next period, starting in 2014. So it's very important. ESCOM submits an application. We have an independent regulator that goes through an independent process in making such a decision. In contrast with MIPD 1 and 2, which both span 3 years, we have proposed this time around that we focus on 5-year determination running from the 1st of April to March 2018. And that is to ensure that a more gradual and more predictable price path is determined for households, for investors, and lenders, rating agencies, and the country as a whole. So instead of dealing with this in shorter periods, do this over a longer period of time. The 5-year revenue request, and it's very important to note, ESCOM submits a revenue request. We do not apply for a percentage increase. We actually submit a revenue request to make up what we require in terms of our cash flow, translates to an average price increase of 13% for ESCOM's own need. And plus the 3% additional support for the introduction of independent power producers. That gives us the total of 16%. This represents a total price increase from the current 61 cents that we charge on average to our customers to 128 cents. In nominal terms, by 2017. This revenue request includes specific savings that we've put in our prime energy costs and specific efficiencies that we have targeted over the period. Chair, now I refer you to the slide on the screen that was there, if we can go back to the slide. And in our presentation, we have presented to you this slide when the team was here the last time, that really ESCOM's application is made up of the rules set by the regulator. Firstly, we have to recover our cost for primary energy, for coal. It is our largest portion of cost. And for that, we require over the next 5 years, 355 billion rand. That's what we require for coal. We then require to pay for the independent power producers. So this will see the first introduction of large renewable energy in the country, solar and wind. and we're going to be paying them 78 billion rand over the next 5 years. Then we have to require to pay our operating costs. That includes both our manpower costs, our maintenance costs, and all the other costs in Eskom. That's 270 billion rand. We've spoken about the integrated demand program. That's the demand side management program in the country. That is run, the solar water geysers, the electrical lights, all of that. The investment in big companies on energy efficiency, that's 13 billion rand. The depreciation that we need, 185 billion rand. The depreciation is there to ensure that we can replace our current assets. And then the return on the assets, which will be from 0.9% return to 7.8% return. That is 100, and that gives us the total revenue requirement. Now, at the bottom of that slide, we have indicated what we've just said, the 61 to 128 cents. That's in nominal terms. And if we look at Eskom's own requirement, and this is the slide that we had in, Eskom's own requirement, the 13% in today's rand, in real terms, means that electricity will move from 61 cents to 84 cents. And this is what we presented to the committee last time. But really, in terms of Eskom's, the real price of electricity today, we suggest it should be 84 cents. Now, the question is, how does that compare? Now, if we have gone back to NERSA's, the energy regulator's determination that they actually made in 2010, and when they made it in 2010, they actually published a document, and the committee will recall that NERSA approved 3 years of 25% tariff increases. We as Eskom went to NERSA this year and requested for not 25 but 16. We actually reduced it for this year. But in that same document, NERSA indicated that South Africa would need another 2 years of 25% increases. So in 2010 already, NERSA indicated that by 2014, 2015, the real price of electricity should be 82 cents. We suggest that instead of doing that over a shorter period, that we get to that level of price over 5 years. And that is the essence of our application and what we put forward. So we've put that in, Jay, to just elaborate that specific point. Then there was a specific question as to why the need for increases. So if we would go through that, it is important that we focus on making sure that the lights in the country stays on, and this certainly has a cost. But we should be very mindful of the fact that historically, electricity is charged below cost-effective tariffs, and that is not sustainable. And we need to transition to a point where we do get to cost-effective tariffs that would support the sustainable electricity industry. It's not just Eskom, it's our broader industry, because we're bringing other investors on board, that has the resources to maintain, to build, all the infrastructure that we need, and make sure, and it's very important as a country, we must focus on energy security. That is our first and foremost priority. The cost of not having energy is far larger than what we need to pay in terms of ensuring that we have energy security. Failing to accommodate the country's energy needs would limit investment, would limit economic growth and job creation. Cost-effective tariff prices minimizes economic distortions caused by inadvertently subsidizing all consumers of electricity. And if the prices are not reflective, then in fact every unit of electricity supplied is subsidized either by the taxpayer or by future users. Now, we have in your document in front of you provided for you a graph of really the problem that we end up with. For decades, the country and Eskom has had electricity prices that was below the level of inflation. And what we've been doing, dealing with over the last few years, has been the correction thereof. So if we look at our document, really we're talking about the price levels now in 2011 being the price levels where we were in 1977 in real terms. That's the last time that the country made this massive investment. And since then, the country had extra capacity, had no need to invest in new capacity. And really, it was only focusing on the marginal cost, the coal cost, and manpower cost. No investments were made. And actually, for decades, both all of the industry and consumers had electricity tariffs increasing less than inflation. And what we're dealing with now, as we have to invest, is you need to then correct that. And that is the correction that has started in the early 2000s that still continues towards moving towards cost-reflective tariffs. In terms of the impact, we certainly understand that this needs to be a transition and that this transition towards cost effectivity poses several challenges. We have taken a position as Eskom that poor households or low-income households or low-consuming households, let me rather say low-consuming households, should be protected from the impact of tariff increases through very specific, targeted, very transparent cross-subsidization in accordance with the national cross-subsidization framework. A failure to achieve cost-effective tariffs sooner will certainly impact our economy and our growth prospects because we would not attract the investment that's required. Jim, many people have been asking me when we get to the end of this. And that's the question. Is end no tariff increases? Is that where we have to end up with? The best way we can explain that is that the end is not zero. The end is inflation. The end is when electricity tariffs would go up at inflation, levels of inflation. And so I'll come back in the next section and talk specifically about really, we should not reference our application again zero. We should reference again, why is it not an inflation? And we'll deal with it. So what we're asking for as Eskom is firstly that in keeping with the Electricity Regulation Act of 2006, Eskom is allowed to recover its cost, provided the cost is efficient and provided the costs are prudently incurred. And this is a process the regulator will go through, and they have done that previously, to make sure that the costs are efficient and prudently incurred. And Eskom is allowed to make a reasonable return. So the revenue that we request will cover the following. And as I said earlier, the first part is primary energy cost. Now, Chair, if I come back to the discussion around inflation, we have asked for 16% on average for 5 years. 16.16. That is what we have on that slide. We have to reference that against where we act with inflation, not against zero. And at least 3% of that goes directly to the reduction of the private sector into the electricity industry, buying renewable energy, buying solar energy, buying wind energy. And we enter into contracts, they're 20-year contracts, to then have that produce in the country. And that gets filtered through to consumers, so South African consumers pay for that, and companies receive those revenues from Eskom. That leaves us with what Eskom requires, and what we said is we require 13%, so the difference between that and inflation, if we assume inflation at 6% over the next few years, is roughly 7%. So the difference between the 7% made up of the four components, and we have to look at the first one is primary energy. Now, there is no ways Eskom can apply for inflation-linked increases if our coal cost goes up at higher than inflation. Coal is 50% of our cost structure. We cannot apply for inflation if our coal cost goes higher than inflation. For MYPD2, for the last 3 years, and including for the first 6 months of this year, which is what we provided to you this morning, our coal cost on average has increased by 18%, 1.8. And this is the cost that we incur in buying coal. And we're the largest procurer of coal. And the coal is supplied by Anglo, the coal is supplied by Billiton, the coal is supplied by Xstrata, the coal is supplied by all the coal mining companies in South Africa. If we would have to charge electricity consumers inflation and pay 18% for coal, we would be subsidizing Anglo, Billiton, and all the coal mining companies. So it's a key component that we have. We have assumed that within this application, our primary energy costs will increase on average 8.6% per year for the MYPD period, and by 11% if we incorporate independent power producers. Because primary energy, the biggest component of that is coal, and then part of that is the purchases of independent power. So we're saying, while we've experienced for 3 years 18% on average increases, we will have to work with the coal industry and everybody has to reduce that closer to around 10%. That is in itself a big challenge. If we have a pact with the industry, the mining industry would come to us and say, we will provide you the right quality of coal, the right volumes, and we will dodge your 6% random, we will change our bus application. But we cannot apply for inflation unless the country deals with the cost of coal. And it's crucially important that we do understand that. So that's the first factor. Why above inflation? Coal is a big problem. Last 3 years we've been running at 18%. We're assuming close to 11%. We can't get to inflation as far as coal is concerned. The next aspect is operating cost. And we've assumed in this 5 years the operating cost will increase on average by 8%. It's higher than inflation. We've assumed, and there's two big components of operating cost, and it's our manpower cost, and it is our maintenance cost. The average fleet of Eskom's power stations is 30 years. They have a life of 50 years. That means we have to maintain them a lot more. The average age of our transformers across the country is anything between 30 and 40 years. The average age of our distribution networks that you see is also around 30 years. And most of what applies this facility in this town, in most of our municipalities, are also 30, 40 years old. That must be maintained. That must be replaced. We have assumed that our manpower costs will be kept at inflation. Certainly, we will. It's a big challenge for us because we recognize we have to negotiate with our trade unions for our bargaining unit staff. For the last number of years, for management, we've kept our manpower costs at levels of inflation already for 3 years. What we have then added is because of the increased maintenance cost, is that makes up the difference between why we cannot get to inflation, because our maintenance costs are a lot more and it is a lot more frequent in terms of the outages. So like us having a car that has to service, the older the car gets, the longer it stays in the garage and the more cost. Very similar analogy. And that's why it's not been possible for us to keep our costs, operating costs, at levels of inflation. So 8% is our assumption. We've taken within that a significant savings target for ourselves. We set ourselves, and I think in the presentation we've put that on, a target that we will have to, over the planned cost that the business has given us, take out 30 billion rand over 5 years in operating costs. And that's what we've set ourselves to drive increased efficiency. The third aspect deals with depreciation. And depreciation increases by just under 10%, and Paul will take us through that in a lot more detail as to the reason for depreciation. It's a very important part. It is key to making sure as a country we don't end up here again making massive cost corrections. By 2020, between 2020 and 2030, Eskom will decommission 10,000 megawatts of the current capacity in the country. We run one of the largest utilities in the world, we produce more than 40% of electricity on the continent. All that will have to be replaced. Depreciation is there to make sure that we have the funds to replace those assets when the time comes that they have to be replaced. Paul will take us through the reasons of that. The fourth aspect is in the aspect around the return. And again, we're going to take quite a lot of time, Chair. There was a lot of questions about the return Eskom earns. How did we determine that? But return moves from 0.9% in 1 year to 7.8%. The regulator has put a pre-tax return target for Eskom of 8.16%. This has been determined from them. And we should recognize that Eskom's weighted average cost of capital is 8.3%. However, over the entire period, the return is less than 4% in terms of pre-tax returns, and Paul will take us through that in detail. See, this then translates to Eskom's revenue requirement that translates to a price increase of 13% for each of the 5 years for Eskom's needs. And taking into account the capacity expansion, the returns and depreciation, and it's very important that we note, we're only planning, in terms of this application, up to our Kusile power station. We know, and we all know, the country has to expand beyond that. Whether Eskom does it or somebody else does that. We have given an indication there of now price application. 3% is then for support of independent power producers, namely the impact of a peaking plant of 1,000 megawatts, and the 3 rounds of renewable energies from independent power producers, totaling 3,725 megawatts, and that then gives us 16%. In terms of the assumptions, Eskom application then assumes clearly that electricity demand will increase by 1.9% compounded annual growth per year over this period. And it's quite important, if I can just stop on the return on the demand increase. For last year, as Eskom, we've seen electricity growing at pretty much flat, 0.2%. For the first 6 months of this year, compared to the first 6 months of last year, electricity growth has been minus 2.9%. Now, it's indicative of what's been happening in the economy, it's indicative of some of the issues had in the mining sector. We run quite an extensive demand side program, so it sees demand reducing. But the assumption that we've taken is 1.9% electricity growth going forward. It is a key assumption because as soon as it goes higher than that, there's a cost impact, particularly coal, firstly, where you would see the increased use of coal to meet that demand. With regard to capacity expansion as a minimum, Eskom will only be required to secure financing up to the completion of its current commitments, which would end at the commissioning of Kusile Power Station in 2018-2019. Provision needs to be made for the 3,725 megawatts of renewable independent power producers. That procurement process has been undertaken by the Department of Energy. Certainly that is in line with the Minister of Energy Section 34 determination and the 1,020 megawatts of peaking plants. Very similar to the gas turbines that we built in the Cape of 1,000 megawatts. There will be single-digit increases in primary energy costs, excluding the IDPs, and that's what we're working towards. A mandatory primary energy conservation scheme. And it's very important. We believe that we do need a conservation scheme in the country, the backstop, as capacity gets extended, and ensuring that we have adequate security supply. Chair, we then just give some background to the context of the application. It's very important that we understand that we make this application with some uncertainty. In the course of where the sector is at, there are long-term decisions that we need to make regarding the building of capacity beyond what we're currently busy with. That is being addressed by government. With regards to the capacity expansion, Eskom's application for new capacity up to the completion of Kusile, that's what it's based on. It includes, obviously, as I said, the independent power producers of about over 4,700 megawatts. And only determinations made by the Minister of Energy up to 30th of September has been taken into account. We know that the country needs additional capacity beyond that. It would be irresponsible for us not to give an indication of what the long-term price path is, to provide some guidance in that regard of potential cost involved. We have modeled two scenarios, and we put that in the application. One scenario where Eskom is tasked to build 65% of the additional capacity, and one scenario where Eskom have to do all of it. We believe that these scenarios provide some reasonable indication to understand the pricing implication of additional capacity in the country going forward, and we have indicated in our application that if we would want to build everything in the IRP under different scenarios, you would actually not need 16%, you would need something closer to 20% for 5 years, and then beyond that, closer to 5%, together with massive equity injections you would need. The Eskom revenue requirement results in a single average increase, which is then translated into very specific tariffs. For the first time in this application, Eskom is dealing with both its revenue requirement as well as the tariff structures that it would require for different sectors. The summarized impact of the different customer categories we have provided previously in the committee, and if we also look at the diagram, and I'll come back to that now. In addition to this, Eskom requests that NERSA considers some modifications to the existing tariff structures, particularly residential tariffs. We believe that that should be significantly simplified to what we currently have to create a better understanding and particularly to optimize protection for low-consuming households, while high-use residential customers and industrial customers pay a more cost-reflective tariff. Further tariff restructuring proposals are also made to make sure that we see more efficient use of electricity and improve certainly the transparency. So as we've presented to the committee the last time, what we have proposed, and if we look at the slide and on our pages, on the right-hand side, and it's very important to mention, if I can just quickly mention, of all our sales, And in our 6 monthly report, we can see that residential customers that Eskom serve, households, we serve close to 4.5 million residential customers. They make up only 5% of our revenue. Most of our sales goes to municipalities. The second largest goes to industry, about 26%. The third largest goes to mining, about 14.5%, then agriculture, and then there is. Eskom's own residential customers makes up 5% of our sales. So when we propose a tariff structure, any of these, it's applicable only to Eskom customers. So when we say all tariffs, that means applicable to all tariff customers. And really what we're applying for next year, we're applying for an increase in the unit cost of electricity of 9.8 cents. That's what we're applying for. And we then, if that is a total revenue requirement, we then have suggested that for municipal tariff, so our tariff to municipalities on average should be 30%, that our tariff to our residential customers that we serve, and we split that up into what we call home light, 20 amp, and that is just low usage of consumers, that we have a flat tariff. And they would see a minus 1% reduction next year. Our medium-term customers in Eskom would see 5%, and the high-end users that are supplied by Eskom making up 14%. Agriculture would see 15%, and the high industrial users will see 21%. And this cross-subsidy, as we've indicated the last time, already exists in our current resources. And yes, to create greater protection for low-income households, the cross-subsidies increase, and this is how it currently works within the industry. But it's very important to note that this is the tariff that Eskom customers pick up. We supply in total, we have about 4.9 million customers. Residential customers are the majority of them. They only make up 5% of our revenue as Eskom. So at the end of the day, Eskom supplies less than about 40% of all households in South Africa. The majority of our households, majority of some of our commercial business sit behind municipalities that then deals with tariffs towards municipalities. So these tariffs are only applicable to Eskom customers. It's not applicable to the whole customer base that are served through our country. In conclusion, as far as executive summary is concerned, Chair, and then I'm going to hand over to Paul to take us through some of the numbers. The submission for this MIPD is the beginning of a public participation process. And particularly for us, the sustainability of the electricity industry is very important, but I think it's crucially important that we ensure security of supply in the country. NERSA is independent, the independent regulator, and they will follow a public participation process prior to making a decision. Stakeholders, as far as we're concerned, should be encouraged actively to participate in the process. And we have, in terms of our application, really looked at striking a balance between the possible short-term negative effects of increasing tariffs, and hence our five-year proposal instead of 3 years. And as I started off, actually when NERSA made the previous application, they suggested 2 further years of 25%. Really, we now, in 5 years, achieve what NERSA indicated 3 years ago we should achieve in 2015-2014. And we recognize the sustainability of the industry and trying to balance that with the country's long-term economic and social needs. Jay, if you would allow me, we can take questions there, or we can continue, and then we'll get into the specific questions that I think the committee is asking. I'm going to ask Paul to take us through that, and I think the first part of it is cash flow, because one of the key issues we must understand, the big part of what we put in front of you is really a cash flow discussion. We're giving you, this is the cash we need. The money we have to pay for operating costs, the money we have to pay for coal, the money we have to pay for the interest on the loans that we have, and there's only one other area that you may want to look at, and that is the area of depreciation. But really, that is the issue, and I'm going to ask Paul to take us through that. But if we turn then where it says responses to questions.
Just a minute. Members, for those of you who were not here right at the beginning, I mean, we did get your apologies, but just to point out that we said, although we schedule this till 9:30, we will complete what we are doing, which may well take us to 9:45. All right? We do need to complete this. So we won't have questions right now, but if people are interested in the odd cup of coffee or something, do just do one at a time or whatever. Thank you. Over to yourself when you're ready then. Is it Mr. O'Flaherty?
Thanks, Jay. I'm on the next page of the conclusion that Brian made, and responding to the question that was raised is that ISCA makes sufficient profits, and therefore why does it need additional 16% increases? Why does it not really just go and raise more debt? And I'll take you to a slide in the Word document, which is our cash flows. And to talk you through that, this is not a profit discussion. This is a cash flow discussion. And what we're asking for is a revenue to ensure that we can pay our operating costs, to ensure that we can pay for our capital program. And whatever their shortfall is, we have to fund through debt. And I don't need really to highlight to the committee that the only sources of funding for ESCOM is debt, is equity injection from government, and then the operating profits from our revenue. Now, on the equity side, we had already requested previously for additional equity injection into ESCOM, but obviously that was not forthcoming, so we did ask for it. So the avenues left for ESCOM is to raise debt, and then to generate enough operating cash flows. And if I refer you to the cash flow slide in front of you and talk you through, Brian already said that when we ask for the revenues for the next 5 years that you see on the slide on the screen, it amounts to just over R1 trillion of revenues. It is required to pay off primary energy costs, including demand market participation of R432 billion. It's required to pay our employee costs of around R135 billion. It is required to pay our demand side management and repairs and maintenance of R138 billion, which leaves cash generated from operations for ESCOM of R390 billion. So we do have cash that's being generated over the 5 years. But what do we need it for? Our capital program over the next 5 years, which includes finishing Kusile, is R337 billion. We are forecasted to spend R65 billion per annum in our capital program. We also have to repay debt that we currently have on our books of R126 billion, and we have to pay the interest on the debt that we're raising of R115 billion. And so we go into a significant shortfall in cash. And how we fund ourselves is we intend raising a further R200 billion in debt to make sure that we can operate. It will take our debt over this period to over R360 billion and coming down to around R333 billion. In order to raise that debt, and the slide is up in front of you, ESCOM is aiming that over the 5 years we become an investment-grade company. In terms of rating agencies today, on a standalone basis, ESCOM is a sub-investment-grade company. That's a junk bond. And we only get to investment grade because of government uplift, because we have strong support from the government. What we're suggesting at ESCOM is that ESCOM and rating agencies have made this very clear to us that ESCOM needs to show that its cash metrics move towards a more sustainable company. And that's the right model from our perspective. And so our cash flows, if we are allowed this tariff, we'll take our metrics, as you can see in front of you, to standalone investment grade metrics, enabling us to raise the debt. I think it is quite a concern for us that the debt we raise is very long term. And some of our debt that we have on our balance sheet today is paid back in 2042. And I think everybody needs to be aware that it's highly critical for ESCOM, because we have long-term assets, that we have sufficient cash to enable us to maintain our plant adequately over the next 25 years in order to pay the debt and fund the interest that needs to be paid. And I think that's a very important point. Should the revenue that we're requiring not be allowed, we would have to go and fund ourselves with more debt and just leverage and leverage Eskom. We would not hit these ratio that you see in front of us, and we would never recover on a standalone basis to be financially sustainable. And we don't think that's where Eskom needs to position itself. On the capital expenditure of 337 billion rand, the 65 billion rand that we are claiming or that we are going to spend over the next 5 years, only half of that is to finish off Kusile. The other half is to make sure that we refurbish our major plant and also to strengthen all our distribution and transmission networks. The question could be asked, and we have some information later in the presentation. Well, Eskom, are you efficient in your capital expenditure? Are you paying more for Kusile, Medupi and Gula than you should be paying, and therefore your capital expenditure shouldn't be at that level? The analysis we'll show you later says that in terms of any benchmark, in terms of the cost of the plant we're building, in terms of what we call the levelized cost, which is the cost of running that plant over its life, we are well within benchmarks. And we recently, and following the committee's concerns last time, we've redone the exercise, redone the independent benchmarks, and Eskom, we're not at the bottom. We're not the cheapest. But we're certainly well within the benchmarks of constructing those plants, and we'll talk about that later. The next point I'd like to highlight to the committee, if you can turn over the page, is, well, Eskom, you ask for an 8.16, or the regulator, and we need to clear this, the regulator in the MYPD2 awarded us an 8.16 pre-tax real return. They didn't give it to us. They said, this is the return you're due. And I'm going to go through a detailed calculation of how it gets there. Eskom actually calculates that the return should be 8.3%. The fact of the matter is we can debate for a very long time as to what this should be, but the fact of the matter is that in our revenue over the next 5 years, we're only asking over the period for 4%. So we're actually asking for half of it. We're actually not asking for the weighted average cost of capital that we believe is ours. If I can just push to the next slide there. And the next one. So what we've done is, and the next one, please. We've had an independent review of our weighted average cost of capital done by our auditors, and obviously we've also independently done it, and we've also had, the previous one. Yeah. And very simply, what we've done is using a standard economic capital asset pricing model. Step one is to calculate your weighted average cost of capital. Step two is to calculate the pre-tax nominal rate, and then step three is the pre-tax real rate. And weighted average cost of capital, quite simply put, is a weighting of your cost of your debt, and that depends on your debt-to-equity ratio, and the cost of your equity. And you add the two together, and you come up with a return that is due to you. Now, I must say, before I go into the detailed calculation, that today, based on the 200 billion rand of borrowings that Eskom has raised in external markets, our average cost of borrowings is over 9% nominal, paying over 9%. So I have heard the debates, but you can go overseas and you can raise debt at 4%, which is true. But as soon as you convert it back to South African rands, you pay an exchange rate effect. And we have no offshore income as Eskom. We only have South African assets. So it costs us at the moment over 9% in interest. If I can go to the next slide and go through the calculation itself. So in order to calculate this, let's start with cost of equity. There was a question raised, as I understand, in this committee that says, you're a public entity, you should be able to borrow at least what the sovereign borrows. Well, if we went to the market today and took the R187, which is South Africa's sovereign's 10-year debt instrument out in the market today, its rate, what the sovereign is paying, is 8.37%. That is a risk-free return because the sovereign is unexpected to go into liquidation. So that's the cheapest. If we take the sovereign rate, it's 8.37%. The next is, will your Eskom And that's the cost of equity, and investing in you may be riskier than the sovereign. So let's add a market risk premium. Now, the auditors have added doing benchmarks as to what Eskom should be, looking at listed companies, and said our risk is at 6%. Now, when you go to the reg, and this is the difference between our calculation and the regulator's calculation. When you go to the regulator has said, yeah, we understand all of that, but we'd like to cap you at 2.4%. So that's fair enough. So I'll go what that means. So the bottom line is, it is, Eskom does require on its equity a higher return in the sovereign because of the risk. The second part is, well, what is the cost of debt? What is the cost of debt for Eskom in a normal environment? And as I said to you today, we're raising it over 9%. We've got to look long term. Again, you take what is the risk-free instrument in South Africa? What can the sovereign raise that? And you take the 8.37%. When you look at what we're actually borrowing above the sovereign, particularly offshore, you have to add on about 2.5% from an Eskom perspective. And so your cost of debt, the cost of Eskom borrowing, is more expensive than the cost of the sovereign borrowing. And then after tax, you apply tax rates, and that gives you a 7.82% cost of debt. You then have to work out, well, how much equity you're going to have and how much debt. And on our long-term models, it shows that we're at 53% equity and 46% debt. And you apply that against those ratios, it gives you on a nominal basis a return of 11.1%. And if you tax it real, it comes to 8.31%. Now, if I made an adjustment at the top on the cost of equity and said the 6% is only 2.3%, if I looked at my equity and my debt and I said, actually, Eskom, you're going to actually be 70% geared. You actually, because we're heading for a debt-equity ratio of about 2.5, so 70% debt, 30% equity, and you do the calculation again, you really don't get to a much of a different answer. And I repeat again that what we're asking for over the 5 years is 4%. We're not asking for the 8.31%. And I think that's an important issue going forward. So we're actually asking for less return than what the sovereign actually borrows in, which is an important point.
Chair, the next question was a question raised around Eskom is a monopoly, Eskom should be broken up. Why is this not done? And this will result in lower prices. Why don't we have two companies and existing and new operations? I think around the existing or new operations, we gave you in our cash flows, you have some sense as to the existing operations, operating costs, the coal costs, and really the new is pretty much the capital for the build. But as Paul has said, of the 337, most of the capex actually goes into the existing business, expanding transmission, making sure the networks work, making sure the plant is refurbished. The structure and the ownership of Eskom is a national issue. We're government-owned, and therefore it's certainly not really a question directed at Eskom. It's a national debate. We should point out that we've been here before as a country. We've been here, we created this crisis as a country, because we went through in the early 90s and said we would privatize it. And we ended up here, and the price of electricity was too low, and nobody built anything. And we used up all the capacity, and now we're having the same debate again. And you have the same commentator saying the same thing that put us in this position. And the main impediment has always been the low price of electricity to attract investors. In 2010, we were asked to solve this funding problem. In 2009, we stopped Kusile, we stopped all our capital after we placed contracts because we had no way as to pay for it. We then had to find 300 billion rand, 30-year plan, and to raise it. And we looked at all the options that is on the table, 45 of them, to fund Eskom. It included selling part of Eskom. It included selling part of our Kusile power station, 49% share in Kusile. And we actually put a project together. Paul went to Asia and to China and the whole of the East. I went to Europe and the whole of America. And we went and tried and sold 49% of Kusile. When we came back and we presented it with a full intergovernmental task team and put the results on the table, the decision was that we should not do it because it was going to be more expensive. The minimum return that any company wanted was any minimum was around 14%, and we have the work we've done it at the time with what is this bank? I think it was Credit Suisse that worked with us, and we saw every investor that wanted to buy this, from the Chinese to the Americans. Minimum return that anybody wanted was around 14%, and the highest return was about 27%. And so anybody that wants to invest in the sector would seek those type of returns. We're the only ones that were able to invest, to make this investment at these returns that the committee see in front of us. So in addition, in the short term, the unbundling of electricity of Eskom and the introduction of private sectors, as far as we're concerned, will not result in lower prices. We have 28 contracts with independent power producers in South Africa. We're the only ones that contract IPPs currently. And IPPs that we currently contract, and it's in our results for the 6 months, are what we call brownfield expansion. This is not somebody building a new plant. This is cogeneration. A big facility, like, let's say, I can give you a company, SAPI, Sasol, they have already a facility, and they add to that facility power generation, and they sell the power back to us. It is the cheapest power we can find in the country. Or for that matter, you take City Power in Johannesburg that operates the power station, the Kelvin. The average price that we pay them for electricity today is 80 cents. 80. That gives us the real price of generation alone today. As we've indicated, today we sell electricity, including generation, including transmission and distribution as Eskom, at 64 cents. And we're asking at the end of the 5 years, we get with all of those three components and our return and our depreciation, we get to that in 5 years, 84 cents. That gives us a sense as to if you ask somebody to come and invest, what the price of electricity is. We have presented to the committee the price of the renewables that we're going to buy. It's on average 2 rand 12 cents. 2 rand 12 cents for a unit of electricity. And the only reason why this country is going to have wind and solar is because we have this extensive base of cheap power from Eskom that we can blend and that makes sure that we can produce it. And so that is the returns that investors get. And the returns are not 7% or 1% or 4%. As we said, when we tried to sell Kusile, the answer we came to, certainly in the short term, you're not going to see lower prices necessarily, because high returns would be required. Then, Chair, there was a question around, will Eskom be willing to supply certain municipal customers directly, explain the rationale in terms of the process of supply for the private sector? We are led to believe certain customers, including retail actors, can be supplied directly by Eskom. These are three factors. There are three factors that we need to consider in this regard. Firstly, and the first thing we must understand, is that constitutional issues in terms of local authorities have the constitutional right to supply within their jurisdiction, particularly as far as electricity is concerned. Secondly, there's obviously a technical issue, whether or not technically have access to a municipal customer, and it depends where the customer is located. Thirdly, there is a financial consequence for the local authority because they would lose the revenue from that customer, if it's a large customer, in terms of their own supply. The approach in this regard will therefore have to be directed by government policy. And this committee would know that I think this House has worked for many years around electricity distribution restructuring, and that never came about. 10 years we took as a country. And we then decided not to proceed with it. And as the fundamental essence of that had to do with the constitutional right of municipalities, had to do with the way our municipalities work and where they get the money from essentially comes out of electricity. And that funds many of the services that happens within the municipality. So when you touch that, you need to relook at the whole business model for a municipality. Currently, when a new customer is needed in an area of supply of the municipality has the right to supply that customer. Where the particular municipality does not have sufficient capacity, or they don't have the infrastructure, or they believe that it will cost effective for Eskom to supply that customer, and if permitted by our technical networks, we will certainly engage the customer directly. I've had municipalities that has come to me and says, we don't have the cash, can you supply the customer? Because they do lose revenue, but they create jobs. they want the factory and the community, then we do step in. Where we can assist, we certainly do that. But we have no basis to do and supply a customer without the consent of the municipality. And as I alluded earlier, the reason why I explained our customers and the status is very important to know that those are the tariffs that Eskom customers sees. And those customers are a very small portion of the 50 million Zaraticans out there. Then there was a question around, has Eskom taken into account that municipalities add significant demand surcharges in electricity tariffs, including non-tariff charges and levies? As we've indicated, the tariff increases that we propose, and essentially it will be determined by the regulator, is 13%. We are aware that municipalities add various cost structures to their customers. However, it's not a matter that we address. It's certainly a matter that is in the scope of the regulator and something obviously the regulator will have to consider. Gee, then I think we can get into the discussion that Paul's spoken about around bolt cost, and I think he's going to take us through the latest benchmark work that we've had for you.
Thanks, Brian. Sorry, the next slide. Okay. There was some presentations, as we understand, made to this committee a couple of weeks ago that said that the levelized costs, in other words, the costs that are going to charge to the consumer of running Medupi and Kusile, could be as much as 95 cents per kilowatt hour. Bearing in mind what Brian said, that our IPPs are coming in at 2 rand 12, and bearing in mind that in the last 6 months we purchased IPPs at about 80 cents per kilowatt hour. So there was an assertion made that, well, Eskom is inefficient and Medupi Kusile will be 95 cents per kilowatt hour. So what we've done is we've done two calculations that are best practice. The first is overnight cost. An overnight cost is, well, what is the cost of your station divided by the megawatts you're installing, and then compare it to other stations around the world. That's the first calculation. The second calculation is your levelized cost. Take your capital cost, take your cost of your primary energy, take your cost of your maintenance over the life of the station, and then discount it backwards and say in kilowatt hour terms versus the 2 rand 12 of independent power producers, what is it that Medupi, Ngule, and Kusile will cost you? Next slide, please. So on an overnight cost basis, and we've used some benchmarks from EPRI, Lazard, and IEA, which are international benchmarks, and this is taking the total cost of the station in dollar terms and dividing it by the number of kilowatts installed. And you can see that Eskom, on the right-hand side in each of those for Medupi, Kusile, and Ngule, is not the cheapest in those benchmarks, but is in line with the international benchmarks from an overnight cost point of view. Next slide, please. More importantly, from a levelized cost point of view, and this is in rand per megawatt hour, so I'll translate it, is that if you look at the right column on Medupi, the right column on Kusile, the right column, Medupi's levelized cost will come in at under 45 cents per kilowatt hour. That's the reality. 45 cents per kilowatt hour versus the IPPs we're buying today at 80 cents versus the IPPs that are coming in the MIPD 3 at 2 rand 12. Kusile comes in at just over 60 cents per kilowatt hour. And Ngula, because it's a peaking plot, so it's not a base load, comes in at 91 cents per kilowatt hour. So these are the benchmarks we have made. We have made these available to presenters like the Energy Intensive User Group. We make these presentations available to the regulator. We made the same calculations at the time of the MYPD2. Obviously, costs have changed slightly. And the regulator goes into these in detail. So these are subject to open audit, as it were. And so we are very comfortable to make the statement that 95 cents per kilowatt hour for the levelized cost of Eskom's plants is incorrect, and also to make a statement that it is cheaper than the IPPs that we are buying.
Chair, I'm going to deal with the next section, and then I'm going to ask Mohammed to continue in the section thereafter. There was a question that as Medupi and Kusile is brought into service over the next few years, that supply will again be a surplus supply. What will be the impact of this be on our pricing approach, and the impact of such surplus will have on the cost base. We have indicated for some time, and we do this, I do this every quarter. We produce for the country a full update on power system. And we've indicated for some time ago that the power system is constrained until we see the commissioning of these power stations. So we operate every day a very tight power system, quite successfully. And that will be the case until we have these units commissioned. And this is pretty much due to the need for the fact, firstly, we've never invested, not for the last 20 years, and we have an extensive need for time to maintain our aging generation fleet and ensure that their long-term sustainability. The last thing we can do in this country is have the existing assets collapse, and so they must be maintained, and we do need extensive time for that. We've identified this from several supply-side options, so hence the fact that we've bought most of IPPs in the country. Demand-side options, hence the fact that we run massive demand-side programs. As we said, such as a short IPP program, the residential demand management program that will assist us. And then also run the 49M campaign that really calls on everybody to save electricity. We have many partners that's working with us. So it's imperative for us. We're not concerned about surplus capacity at this point in time. We're certainly concerned about making sure that these units are commissioned together, obviously with the IPP program within the country. We have raised the issue around having a safety net in the system in the country to make sure we never go back to load shedding. The growth rates are lower than what we have as a country in IRP. The electricity growth rates that we now have in MYPD3 are lower than what we have in a new growth path, in the National Development Plan, and in IRP. So there may be in the short-term adequate reserve. This will disappear very quickly. We must understand Medupi that we're building now should have already been built long time ago if we made the decision early. So Medupi and Kusile is absolutely necessary in terms of energy security for South Africa. And Eskom, we have pointed out in our application that we are not addressing the country's necessary need beyond the Kusile power station that we're currently building. Given the importance of electricity in the economy and having a safety net, it's crucially important to make sure that that is in place, to make sure that we cannot go through any commodity boom again and have electricity constraining our economic growth. And I think that's crucially important that the investments continue and these be completed. Mohammed, if you can take the next section.
Thank you. The issue that has been raised relates to the impact of the price increases on the economy, especially on energy-intensive users. As we indicated the last time we presented to the committee, that this has been one of the things that's been uppermost in our mind in compiling our application, because we do recognize that any increase will have an impact on the economy. We've also been guided by the request by the State President to find a price path which will ensure that Eskom and the industry remain financially viable and sustainable, but it remains affordable for the poor, which stimulates jobs, which grows the economy. If we start with the first issue, and that is, the first fact is, whatever we do to maintain current operations, to pay for maintenance, to pay for fuel, there's a cost. To build for the future, to have a balance sheet that allows accessibility to borrow funding, to service the debt, also costs. Of course, there are issues around efficiency. We've tried to demonstrate how Eskom is benchmarking itself, what we are trying to do around efficiency. So whatever you do around the efficiency debate, at some point you're going to come to a landing that says, you can't get away from the fact that to maintain current operations, to build for the future, there's a cost. The only question that then remains is, how do you pay for that cost? And that's what the application is about. And here we have attached an extract from our application to the written response to the committee, where we've started showing some of the comparisons. Our view is the optimal way to pay for these costs is to migrate to cost-effective tariffs. What we believe that we are doing for the economy is not to insist or try and move there too quickly, is not to try and get there overnight. And as you've seen from the first slide, is we're actually moving out what should have been cost-effective tariffs in about 2 years' time, right at the end of the MYP3 period in 5 years' time. The advantage of cost-effective tariffs, firstly, from a energy usage perspective, you get the right price signals for energy efficiency and you can promote energy efficiency. The second is, if you don't have the right price signal, in essence, it amounts to the shareholder, the taxpayer, someone subsidizing all electricity users with a shortfall between cost-effective tariffs and the price that's actually been paid. And the largest customers would then be the beneficiary of that subsidy. And from an economic perspective, again, it's not an optimal way to fund what we need. We've done some studies in terms of looking at options to make up the shortfall. So VAT, looking at it from a tax perspective. And as you'll see in the document, the conclusion of those studies is it will actually be a bigger burden on the customer base, generally of South African citizens, if you try and do that through a broad tax base, as opposed to using the user pay principles that get you to cost effective tariffs. We have also highlighted some of the disadvantages of moving to cost effective tariffs. So the one issue around cross-subsidization of our tariffs, we've acknowledged that it is contrary to the pure principle of cost effective tariffs, but it's an exception we believe that is very necessary given where we are as a country, given the need that we have for access for the poor to have access to services, and you know the fact that we need to grow as an economy. The other issue we have conceded, and I think the committee has also raised questions about this, is as prices increase, you do have concerns around more bad debt, more theft, and it's an issue we need to deal with differently. I don't think the solution to that is not to migrate to cost-reflective tariffs. So on balance, with all the economic impact studies we've done, the conclusion is that on balance, the best way, but it's optimal from an economic perspective, is to migrate in a systematic manner to cost-effective pricing. The key and the critical question is choosing the right migration path. And what we've tried to do with the application, and you see it here from the less than 4% returns we showed, that we believe that the migration path we've demonstrated is one that strikes the appropriate balance. The other point that has not been made is that there's also a tipping point for Eskom. So at some point, if you only look at affordability without looking at viability for the industry, that you will repeat the mistake of the past. In other words, we will be back to a funding challenge like we were 2 years ago. Thank you.
Jay, I'm going to deal with the next section, but let me just touch on the last moment raised. We have been here before where we had to stop our capital. If we get to the point, and as you said, this is very much cash flow based, if we get to the point where we will not put, we cannot put the company at risk, you know, we would have to look at curbing back our capital. Quite simply, we will stop. We have to deal with our commitments that we've entered into. But it means that we will have to look at the refurbishments and start cutting back those things. But we cannot put the company, we will not put the company at risk from that perspective. But let's deal with the next issue. The energy intensive user group, certainly in terms of the cost of maintenance, we hire that unplanned outages over 14%. And mostly unplanned and planned. The figures are not correct. Our unplanned ratio for the year is 10.5%. It is above our own target. We have a target closer to 6%, but it's well below 14%. Then there's a suggestion, and the reason the 10%, the 10.5%, we have this year decided to do two specific things. One is we have our plant. We should take our plant out to control our particulate emissions. Now, to give the committee a sense, we have a license where the stuff coming out of our stacks, we need to control the amount of ash coming out. Now, this plant needs to be maintained. We don't have time to maintain it. And if the coal qualities are bad, and when we say coal quality, I mean if we get 45% ash in our coal, which we're currently getting, we can't control the ash going out. So in order to stay within the limits during the day, we actually reduce the load of the plant. That is seen as unplanned. And so that contributes to the 10%. The second thing that we do is over weekends, if we have an opportunity to maintain our plant, we actually take the plant out. That is not seen as planned maintenance. It's seen as unplanned, but it's the right thing to do. And so that contributes about 2.5%. And you look at our results very carefully that we've produced yesterday, 2.5% of that. So 7.4%. So there is a lot of work that we're doing on making sure our plant is reliable. It's not where we want to be. But we simply do not have the time to maintain the plant. And so the whole fleet is becoming increasingly unreliable. So there was a suggestion that we should target the ratio of 90% availability, 7% planned outages, and 3% unavailability. This is an aspirational target, and Eskom's actually achieved this in the 1990s. We have achieved it. We've achieved it at the time when our fleet was younger, and we had achieved it at the time that we had excess capacity. When we had excess capacity, we could take our plant out and do the maintenance we need when we needed to do it for long as we needed to do it. Since then, we've used up all the capacity. We can't do that. So today, we keep the lights on every day, And if we have a situation where we cannot meet that, we move the outages around. And that's why we've asked customers to save, to create the space for us to do the outages. So what we've added here, and I refer to the slides, and if you go to the next slide, it's just a little bit bigger than what's on your document. We have then given you the benchmark, and we do these benchmarks annually, which refer the VGB, VGB members, it's a European Power Industry Association. It comprises primarily of most of the European coal plants, RWE, E.ON, most of them, particularly in Germany, and the rest of Europe. So this is a benchmark of Eskom plant against, excluding our Kuwait plant, against the European benchmark. The solid lines indicates the VGB benchmarks, and the dotted lines indicate Eskom benchmark. It's got three. It's got a top quartile, which means our best performing plants, or VGB's best performing plants. It has got a medium, which includes our medium quartile performing plants and our worst quartile performing plants. The first factor that we look at is what we call load factor. So it gives some sense of the fact of how hard do we actually run our plants against European power stations. And as you can see, whether it's our worst performing plants, whether it's our best performing plants or the medium plants, the Eskom plants runs at the higher load factor than the European plants. So it says the plants work a lot harder. Now, because we have not invested in capacity, the current capacity has to carry the load to meet the demand. So that's the first thing. Plants are operating at a higher load factor. The next part is then to look at, and that's the benchmark from 1999 to 2011. Then we have a benchmark which we look at very carefully. The next slide is the energy availability factor. So this gives us a sense of the availability of the plant. Now, from that perspective, again, similarly, the European plants is the solid lines and the dotted lines, Eskom fleet. So we can look at the best Eskom power stations. And so the best Eskom power stations are performing better than the best European power stations while they're being run harder. We look at, for that matter, the medium performance, and there we can see, yes, the availability has come down on them particularly over the last few years, but they're still comparing better, if not at the same level of an average to European plants. Our worst performing power stations in Eskom, most of them are 40 years old, most of them is quite old, are performing better than the worst performing plants in Europe. Yes, the trend is downwards in availability, and that's really got to do with the effect that we do need more time to maintenance. The next aspect is then the aspect that focuses on the 3%, which is unavailability. Again, a similar trend. The best performing power stations in Eskom is performing unavailability close to 2%. It is increasing now. You can see over the last few years, particularly as you run them a lot harder. And I can say to you, Chair, that our power station manager has got one wish. And every time I meet with him, this is the one wish. Give us the time to do the maintenance to maintain the plant, and particularly the newer fleet. But their performance have deteriorated over the last few years, but they're well within the benchmark of particularly, in this case, the fleet within the European power station. So the medium of Eskom UCLF has deteriorated. We recognize that because we've not been able to take the plant out, but it performs in line and not worse than what you have in Europe. Now, these are actually an annual report, an integrated report of Eskom of March 2012. So if you look at our annual report, you look at our website, the committee should be able to get these benchmarks. Chair, then it was a specific factor. Now, in 2008, and we've taken out of NERSA's, actually, NERSA commissioned a study on Eskom's generation cost drivers within the price review. They conducted what they call a core consulting group in the U.S., and the following statement was made that Eskom Generation has managed to become a world leader in power plant operations. Its fuel, non-fuel operating and maintenance costs per kilowatt hour and plant availability factors is an upper to 10% of large integrated utilities worldwide. Now, this is not our report. It is a NERSA report, and we've given you some reference to that. On the next slide, we have ourselves commissioned in 2009 McKinsey to take all of Eskom's power stations I don't see the slide on there, but on your page, on your document, and then take each of our power stations and look at our operating and maintenance costs and stack them up against all power stations around the world. I think we had one power station, our Camden station, which was newly commissioned, that was in the third quartile of power stations. we had our most of Eskom's current power stations in the bottom quartile. Now, the reason why we're actually able to do this is because we build these big power stations and then we run them with only a few people, and the cost is then a lot lower. And that has always been a success. You must understand, South Africa built an electricity system where we built coal power stations next to coal mines to bring the coal across invaders. So we use relatively cheap coal. And that's how we actually developed the country between Eskom and the mining industry. And we built these big power stations, which you don't see in the rest of the world, because we use this one management team. Same stations, they look the same, so we can share the space, and then we maintain this whole fleet. And it has been very competitive for South Africa. So as we presented to the committee, in our presentation, our current generation costs will range, by the end of the 5 years, we produce from our current fleet of power stations electricity at 30 cents. 30 cents for every unit of electricity. So we still have within our fleet very, very cost-effective production in terms of electricity. We also looked at other factors. The second focuses on two aspects. It's our distribution business. So this is, how does Eskom's distribution business perform? So we looked at two factors. The one is called SAIDI, and if I can just explain that. SAIDI means the System Average Interruption Duration Index. What it is the measure, and I do apologize for all the, but it's a measure of really the amount of time that customers is without the duration of an interruption. And then SAIFI is the system average interruption frequency. So how often do you have such an interruption? And what we've provided there for the committee is an average for the Polish utilities, the South American, the Europeans, and the top performers. Now, in the case of Eskom, our current SAIDI performance, and I didn't put it up there, we'll put it up there, our current SAIDI performance is 43 hours. So versus the rest of the world, it's very low, ours is 43, so it's very high. It's not where it should be, but it's very unique to our power, our distribution customers, because we have long lines to service rural customers. So if we would take our top customers and our city customers, we'll see our SAIDI performance is very equal to that. But if we take all our customers, particularly our rural customers, they see longer duration outages. In terms of the frequency, our frequency is around 23 hours, or 23 times, versus the best being around 5 or 4. And so we have quite an extensive investment. And Paul says half of the capex is going to go into distribution. It's really part of the investment to strengthen the networks into rural customers. So many times the rural community is supplied by a single line. And if something happens on that line, you lose the customers. And in many other countries, you would have redundant supplies into it. So that is many of the capex investments that we'll be going in. So the next slide is one that focuses on then our transmission business. And this is work that our transmission division has done around their benchmarking. It gives you an average.
I just want to say, we'd like you to complete in about 5 minutes or so, so that we can just engage on the issues.
Thank you, Chair. We'll be done. Gives a transmission benchmark. It gives you an average cost, total cost per network length. So at the bottom, it measures the network length. And on the top hand side, gives you the cost. And this is the comparison with European utilities. You can see where Eskom lies at the bottom end. We're well within the benchmarks in terms of the length of our networks and the costs being low. And in the same time, in terms of the average cost per consumption, so the consumption in terms of the total network versus the cost of selling that consumption. And as you can see, Eskom lies well within the benchmark of, in that case, European transmission companies. We do run a tight power system, and we have to do more maintenance, and therefore we recognize the need that we're currently balancing our plant performance against certainly our availability factors. Chair, the last question was very, very briefly. It's not clear whether or not Duva was included in the capacity. Duva is regarded as part of our existing capacity and therefore not reflect under additional capacity that we expand, and it's included as part of our existing capacity.
What did you say?
Duva. Duva. Chair, in conclusion, thank you for the engagement, and we certainly, from our perspective, extend our appreciation with the interest that the committee has shown. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Dalman, I must say this has been a very, very constructive and in-depth, I don't even want to say overview, but it's somewhere between an overview and an in-depth. We certainly do have better understanding. But perhaps because we have a better understanding, we have more questions. But thank you to you and your team. Over to members. Honourable Hill Lewis, Honourable Khadebe, Honourable Van der Merwe, Honourable McIntosh.
Thank you very much, Mr. Thomas. I appreciate you being willing to come and engage us in such depth. It's a matter of great concern to this committee, and it's really great to have the opportunity to engage with you at this level. Last time your colleagues took issue with my interpretation of your numbers, and that's fine. I appreciate that. I'm not a financial expert, but I have spent quite a lot of time over the last couple of weeks really looking at these numbers, trying to get to grips with them. Because of course it is the case that when you come to committee, you present what seems as such a reasonable case for why you must have these price increases, and this, you know, this often used phrase, cost-reflective tariffs. And I've tried to understand that and get to grips with that in my own mind. And I'd like to challenge your definition of cost-reflective tariffs. You know, we hear all of the companies and the businesses and the industry sectors that have come before this committee saying, and I must agree with it, that the tariff structure you've proposed or that you've requested presents a extremely dangerous threat to the industrialization and economic growth and future success of business and job creation in our country. And so I want to challenge your definition of cost-reflective tariffs. If I look at your numbers, and I've tried to go into them in depth, challenge me if I'm wrong, but this is about depreciation. Now, you said that obviously depreciation is a cost, you must account for it, but from what I can see, you've revalued all of your existing capacity at what it would cost to replace it now, and then depreciate against that and listed that at a cost. Now, is that correct? Now, that's, as I understand it, unorthodox at best. But you know, it would seem to suggest that you're accounting for the need to replace every single current megawatt capacity in the near future. When in fact, as you've said yourself today, a certain proportion of it you will need to replace, of course, but certainly not every single existing power station needs to be replaced. But that's what you're accounting for, and that's what's being included in your cost-reflective tariff application. That doesn't seem right to me. Secondly, if you look at the way that you've accounted for depreciation as well, it seems that you're revaluing those assets each year. Again, correct me if I'm wrong, which means that not only are you saying this is what it would cost to replace this power station right now, but you're saying we're going to revalue that asset next year and then calculate depreciation on the revalued asset. Again, that is, if I'm correct in that interpretation, very unorthodox. Then let's talk about your targeted return. You say that there's a 4% targeted real return over the medium term, but it is, I mean, as a matter of fact, in your documents you say you are targeting an 8% return in the final year. You're moving towards an 8% real return on capital. Now, sir, again, I put it to you, thank you for your answer in the document, but I can't accept it. You know, if you look at the Joburg Stock Exchange, I just checked, over the last 10 years, the Joburg Stock Exchange has returned on average 6.6% per year. That's in the equity market. Now, if you go to any stock exchange investor and say to them, we're offering you on average 8% real return above inflation in a very low-risk utility investment, jeepers, people will be beating down the door to sign that. It just seems to me, again, I put it to you, that a target 8% real return above inflation is exorbitant. It's unnecessary for this kind of company. As I said, the JSE would be proud. But in this case, that return is being funded by ordinary South Africans and business people and employers and small entrepreneurs. The cost reflective tariffs that you've calculated must be worked out on the basis of the marginal cost of new generation, not on the including the depreciation cost of existing generation capacity. I think that that's the thing. So what I want to say, I don't want to take up too much time, other members have got, but sir, I want to say to you, you've got a company that is building a balance sheet that would make any company in the world proud. It's a balance sheet to hold up as a model. And I put it to you that we, Eskom doesn't need that kind of balance sheet in a country that we're living in at the moment. You've got a different social mandate, you've got a wider social mandate other than simply the pursuit of profit. And here you are trying to build in the next 5 years balance sheets that might just sacrifice industry and business and job creation and growth in this country on the altar of the Eskom balance sheet. I don't think that that's right or fair, and I don't think it's necessary.
Thank you. I did give you a little leeway there. Yeah, Honourable Hadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm moving from the point that in the last presentation I was not in. I was in the other meeting. Perhaps I might have missed some of the issues you raised there. But I think that when you go back to this issue, you look at the import. In order to calculate what comes out at the end, the price, you must look at the input which comes in. It's surprising that the issue of the major cost is the primary energy, which is the coal. And then, being the coal, it's also surprising that why is it so costing so much when we're having so much coal as a country? When you look day in, day out, you see a lot of long trains, which have just shipping goes straight to Richards Bay, out of the country. And then, but at the same time, you find that Eskom has to pay then around 18% increase on the issue of coal. So when you look back, Chair, on the issue of the iron ore itself, the government had taken a stand some time back when it privatized ISCO, that what they'll expect to happen is that ISCO will get a price at a cost plus 3%. Can't we have that height of a new dispensation for ESCOM itself? Because really, we cannot afford, if this commodity is here, and then if China is drawing this coal out so that they can grow their economy, and at some time that asset is not being used to fuel our economy, and then there's a serious problem around that. And then the other issue, Chair, will be the issue of the operating cost. It was very clear that it was the issue of manpower plus maintenance. So usually when you speak about manpower, you speak about, the salaries which you pay your employees. I think that one is the largest factor, the training you put into place. When they compare with other utilities in the world, how do their salary which compare to those? Are we paying excessively as a country, or as companies, is it paying their compensation for their employees excessively compared to others so that others become competent? And the issue of maintenance, this issue, I was very happy, Chair. I visited Ngula. Yeah, Ngula is in my constituency. The president was there the other week. I really appreciated the way they assembled the turbines. They're from Siemens. It was from Siemens, Germany. But they were assembled on site. I did pay a visit to that. I did pay a visit. They were being assembled on site, which really goes a very long way toward in creating jobs for the local economy. But the issue, the near long term, what type of agreements do they have with the suppliers of turbines? So that a lot is produced in the country, because we have to industrialize. So when you industrialize, when you look at the type of metals we're having, the minerals we're having, I think we're having abundance that we can create an industry out of that. Because really, if you look at Africa, when you're moving out, Africa is a tough continent. So I think that if we can use, of course, as a springboard, moving forward, create that thing within the country, what possibilities are there? Thank you, Chair. As I said, that I missed the first presentation. They might have been fed or extended during that time, but that way, really, I'll appreciate it here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Kadebe. Honourable Van der Merwe.
Chair, I would like to ask your indulgence. Would it be possible for us to get an answer to those two questions before we ask ours? because I think it might contribute to the discussion.
I see you're comfortably chewing, Honourable McIntosh, so it may be the time. No, never mind, who's next up? Right, we'll get the response.
Thanks, Chair, and thanks, Member, for the questions. And let me start with the last remark, that it seems as though Eskom is building a model balance sheet. Let me start with that because the rest just translate backwards. What is true is that we are saying that in 5 years' time, we need to have credit metrics, balance sheet, funds from our operations that support us to be an investment-grade company. And the logic behind that is that we currently have support from the government to the extent of 350 billion rand guarantees, of which we only intend to use about 150 billion. And the reason for that is if you look at the government's debt to GDP ratios, if the government had to step in and fund all the debt of Eskom of 350 billion, the knock-on effect onto the sovereign would be extreme. And so we're saying that Eskom needs to build, 100% what you're saying, a strong balance sheet to be able to support future growth. That is true. And then going back into your questions is the rate of the return. If you look at any pension fund, provident fund, and the investments that people are making today, there's still a healthy percentage of all investments that are going into equity. So I think the equity you quote, it excludes the dividends that people are getting as well. You have to add not only the return of the stock exchange, but the dividends that are coming in. And so they are higher on average than what we're asking for in terms of, because the government bond is at a risk-free rate. The last question on depreciation is a very interesting one, and it's spot on what you've said. If I was a mining company and I was building one mining shaft and I was dependent on a gold price, I would not want, if all I invested in was that one shaft and I want to make as much money as I could, I would only think about what I invested in that shaft, and as long as I got my depreciation back from the original historical cost, I don't actually care. I've made my money. Eskom actually sets the price of electricity for the country. The fact that it's only Eskom is a moot point. So when our capacity needs to be replaced in 10 years' time, the cost of replacing it is significantly higher than the cost today. So if I built a power plant for 100 rand today and it lasted 5 years, I would need 20 rand every year to repay it. In 5 years, that same plant, because the foreign exchange, what have you, is 200 rand, so I need 40 rand. So you would go from a price of 20 rand, you'd have these spikes. So what this depreciation does, gives you an incremental increase in price so that you don't have price shock, which is what we're exactly experiencing today. That we never had real price increases over 25 years. We suddenly want to build. It costs an enormous amount of money, and we've got these price shocks because the debt we have to raise and the equity we have to invest costs a lot more. And that's the theory behind what we're saying. But it all translates into this desire of Eskom to be standalone investment grade and have a strong balance sheet.
Yeah, I think on that question, we should add and give the committee two things. One is we should give you the benchmark of other utilities' balance sheets. We've actually done that, and then you can have a look at how ours compare versus theirs. And I think we have it, and we should provide you with that. So we will do that in writing. The other question I'd like to make, and the first question, is that we have to be clear that we must implement the regulations that we have in the country. So depreciation based on the revalued asset base has been decided on by NERSA through a public participation process. And so our application is in line with the regulations in the country. And it's very important for investors and for everybody else looking at us that we stick to certainty. If we change our regulations every time it doesn't suit us, it creates a great sense of uncertainty. So we have not applied and unorthodox we have applied in terms of the regulations that currently exist. If I address Honourable Khareva's questions, the first one is the coal, and you're very right. I mean, the coal is the biggest issue. And really the question was around, can we not have similar to a cost-plus type arrangement to control the cost? I think as South Africa, we should be quite clear. We have enough coal, and it's in the ground. We're still beyond 2018. We face as a country a significant shortfall because we have to open up the mines. We need the investment in new coal mining to supply Eskom current assets, not for new things. And so between now and 2018, we have contracted over 80% of all our coal that we need. And it comes in three contracts. The first part of our contract, the largest part of our supply of coal, is what we call cost plus, very similar to what you say. Cost plus. So we pay on those mines all the cost. We have paid all the capital to establish the mine, and we don't pay the refurbishment capital, and the mining company gets some return, and those are Billiton, Anglo, all those companies. So we are exposed to the cost increases on those mines. So it's still our cheapest coal, but if the cost year on year of coal mine goes up more than 5% or 10 or 18, we're exposed to those costs. We're exposed to the cost as well as the volumes. So, for instance, if they do not produce enough coal for a power station that year that will come via conveyor, we will have to truck coal in. Now, as soon as we do that, we double the price. So it's very important that the volume come out of the station and that we get the costs contained by the mining companies. The second part of our coal, which makes up about 25% of our coal supply, is what we call fixed price or index contracts. So this is where the mine gives us constant volumes. The price has been fixed, and it indexed. It changes every year, primarily driven by PPI. And so that coal costs still the second cheapest coal. It's fine for us. So, and the mine must give us the volumes. The third level of coal is where we do not have coal next to our power station. So that's where we have five-year contracts. It comes in slightly higher cost, and we transport it. And by the time we put it on truck, the time it gets to the power station, it's more expensive. And so it is true that we have cost plus in, and mines have to earn a return, but we certainly believe going forward that the country needs to look at this crucially. The only way we can control energy costs in the country, if we use our natural resources we have, it is strategic, and we must use it to make sure we contain our energy costs. And there needs to be a balance between that and the balance to how do we make sure there's export revenues earned for the country and the companies invest. But I can give you an example that many mining companies look at capital. Today, when a mining company has to put capital into a project in South Africa, they look at that capital competing against a return with them putting capital into South America, somewhere else. And that's the reality of capital. And so we have looked in some of our newer projects at us also participating and putting the capital in, because it's the only way we can keep some of the coal costs lower. That strategy we have not fully put into our price application in terms of our capital costs. So if we would have to invest massive amount of capital in our mines, in new mines, we have not taken that strategy into account in our 337 billion capex. So hopefully that deals. The second part was manpower costs and salaries are comparisons. We do not compare with utilities internationally. It's just going to be too expensive in paying. We have good skills, as Eska. We obviously have to negotiate our salaries with our bargaining unit staff, and 85% of our staff are bargaining unit staff, union staff. So we have to negotiate with the unions. We are comparing against the local South African industries. In terms of bargaining unit staff, normally they are paid slightly better, if not on benchmark for the industry. We pay all people at ESC, competent people around between the 25th percentile of the market and the median. And normally ESC people are well paid, but they were skilled. For the managerial staff, they were probably lower than what you would see in the South African benchmark. We've had a threat to our skills to international power companies. Eskom people are well trained and they're well experienced, and so somebody else comes to South Africa, take our operators, and then they leave. So it is an issue. It's very important. It's a complex business. It's technically very complex, and we have to have competent people. The manpower costs include a significant amount of training costs. Last year we spent 1.4 billion in training. We have 12,000 trainees, 2,000 engineers, 2,000 artisans, and 700 technicians. Crucially important for us in terms of the future. Then you had a question around the long-term turbines that you're talking about. On our build program, of all the contracts we've placed now on our build program, we've placed 85 billion rand on the South African companies. And 63% of everything that we do in our build program comes out of South Africa. Unfortunately, turbines are not a big part of that. And the reason why is because we have to have a long-term plan. And somebody to set up turbines here, they need to know they're going to make 60 of these things. But we have been able to do it with boilers and many other things where we could increase the localization within the country. So yeah, I think that answers the two questions.
Thank you very much. We'll always come back if there's something outstanding. But let's try and go through with the rest now. And that is the Honourable Van der Merwe, the Honourable McIntosh, and then the Honourable James. And then when you and you right, let's get a newcomer first, the Honourable Salah, and then yourself again. Ah, another one. Yeah, Honourable Elvis, and then Honourable Hill Lewis. Right. Do go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you also to the presenters. I have a little sympathy with ESCOM because I'm sure you must appear before several portfolio committees, energy, you know, public enterprise and so on. But our interest here is manufacturing and industrial policy. So this whole set of debates arose as a result of us receiving public comment on the way in which the IPAP is unfolding. And what we have heard, to be quite frank, from small and medium enterprises is that contrary to our desire that we should grow that section of our economy, it is shrinking and people are closing down and they universally hook the blame on the cost of electricity. Now, we are also fully aware that the municipalities play a very big role in this, and you've described that to some extent in your reply to our questions. And we've seen the enormous margins that are charged over and above the mega flux rate that you supply to municipalities. However, I can't help but think that there must be something where we can relate the growth of industry and ESCOM and the municipalities in a more virtuous triangle than is currently the case. I am concerned because we've been told by these people that they're actually looking for interim relief because companies are closing down next month, by the end of the year, early next year. And these are from the manufacturer circle people as well as the foundries industries and those sort of smallish to medium-sized businesses. You've talked about not providing shocks, but shocks is exactly what people are experiencing at the moment. I really would like a comment on that. I'm also concerned, that's my first point. My second point is I'm very concerned that we grow faster than your predictions in the future. You're talking about a growth in your demand by 1.9%. What if the economy does recover substantially in the next 3 years and starts growing at 4 and 5%? That's where we were in 2007, I think it was, and that's what caused all this problem. So it seems to me that there needs to be a balance between saving electricity and increasing your customer base. And I'd like a comment on that because We would need a bigger customer base if the economy is going to grow, but have we got enough supply? So how is that balance going to take place? I would like also your comment. You briefly mentioned, Mr. Damas, the question of the municipalities and the REDS, what was called the REDS then, and how that whole program has been shelved. I'd like to have your opinion, or ESCOM's opinion, on how that kind of equation can unfold now, because, you know, as we see, Johannesburg municipality is charging 700-something% over the mega flux rate, Nelson Mandela Bay over 500%. And obviously they are sustaining their own budgets through this cost. It can't be right. There must be another model that we can adopt in this to make this thing work a little bit better and actually save industry and in fact promote it so that we get more manufacturing going rather than less. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Honourable Max.
Madam Chair, thank you. I think Honourable Funamara has enabled me to shorten my question considerably because I think she's raised the really important points. And I think we must try to wear a DDI cap here. We're not the Energy Portfolio Committee. I do have one or two just very short information. I didn't want to interrupt the presentation. That SAIDI and SAIFI, slide, which was really interesting, talked about Poland and so on, but you didn't explain where South Africa was. Look, we have a very small print here in front of us. That's the one question. Where do we compare?
What was also interesting is you compared the U.S. and South America. But when you did the VGB, of all these acronyms, I don't know what that means, you didn't, in the VGB slide, you didn't put in China. Do you have any figures on China and their generation costs? And also the United States? Because I think that VGB comparison was entirely Eurocentric rather than other countries. Those are just two things. The CEO, and let me say, Madam Chair, from my perspective, I've been an Eskom agricultural consumer since 1970, and I still have 6 installations which I pay for every month, and it's very painful to have to pay these increased prices. But I'm a champion for Eskom. I think we went through the horror of those electricity outages in 10 years ago or 5 years ago, and I don't think South Africa wants that again. And as far as I'm concerned, a healthy Eskom, financially and every other, is non-negotiable. And anyway, the minister, Madam Chair, already said he's supporting the 60% tariff increases. So that, of course, puts me as an opposition member in with no dilemmas, but my colleagues in the ruling party obviously don't want to contradict their minister. but Madam Chair, what my concern is, and this is the DDI issue, and my colleague, Honourable Van der Merwe, put the point on, is, and Mr. Dames said, he's perfectly happy to look at ways in which Eskom can supply directly, provided it's done by negotiation with the local authorities. Because there are rules. Eskom can't simply move in. And Madam Chair, as we heard horror stories of how local authorities, which have traditionally for decades balanced their books by adding onto the electricity rate, but some of them are just completely out of control. And that's not Eskom's fault, I don't believe. And the other thing we've got is even, and particularly for example, that foundry that's being mothballed in Newcastle, Natal, they said if they could get electricity at the Eskom price, they could carry on. But they can't because they have to buy it from the local authority. And similarly, those guys in Velcom, who are doing great jobs, manufacturing, mining equipment, they employ a lot of people. I mean, it's just a nightmare for them. And I can use other examples. So that's the one real question I've got, is how feasible is it? And Madam Chair, I didn't hear, and you were away last week, I was as well, I didn't hear the SALGA presentation. And I'm sure that our chairman and other people gave SALGA a hard time on this issue. Because they are the people is the problem from a manufacturing perspective. The second question is local procurement. Now, I was really pleased to hear what the policy is to try to have local procurement. But let's take things like IPP. And I understand IPP is a very expensive form of energy. Coal's the best. We must go for coal. We must just manage it and have a clean coal policy. But things like solar panels, solar tubes, and all that sort of thing. Manufacturing that solar stuff and the photovoltaic can all actually be done in South Africa. Or we may have to, through IPAC or through DGI, create more of that. But I think Eskom could as well, so that it could possibly increase the subsidy on, and I know it's a minuscule part of your budget, but it could make a big difference to job creation in South Africa if there were bigger subsidies for South African-made solar panels, solar tubes, etc., etc. And also, for example, I see somebody starting to do these big wind vanes, manufacturing in South Africa. I think our engineering industry is perfectly capable of manufacturing the wind turbines and wind mills, I suppose they are, for them. Thank you. Those are my two basic questions.
Right. Thank you. Honourable Salah?
Thank you, Madam. I think the issues of pricing, my colleagues have already dealt with, although to an extent a little point that have not been touched is insofar as it creates conflict between Eskom and communities up there around the price of Eskom and the price of municipalities. The discussion, somewhere some people were even suggesting that why was the matter is still being addressed, shouldn't ESCOM charge the same price as municipalities, so that at least there shouldn't be people having the option to then want to do something different. I think the matter that maybe in the response to Honorable Father Mervis and Honorable Becky Torres' question may come. Also in relation to the issues of IPP's prices versus the prices that you want to charge. The two questions that now remain for me is the issue of whether ESCOM is not in any way involved or going to get some kind of share from the present infrastructure finances, the current infrastructure built that is there. The second one is the issue of Kusile, Midupi and Ingula. I'm aware that there are changes in relation to their anticipated completion. What are the new anticipated period of completion of this project?
Thank you very much, Honourable Salah. Honourable James.
Thank you very much for a very compelling presentation. I had one question, and that is to do with the proposal that's been floating around regarding the establishment of what's called a cost reduction caucus. Something's been tried elsewhere in the world, in the Netherlands and Germany, where your main stakeholders, in this case it would be government, public sector, private sector, trade unions, and even NGOs would get together in a caucus to look at how to keep administrative prices down. And I can't remember whether there's ever been a decline in electricity prices in this country. That is, whether there's ever been an instance where any savings or a drop in commodity prices globally results in savings being passed on to consumers. But in any event, the question is whether you would be willing to be part of such a caucus. It's a NEDLAC of sorts. I mean, I'm not a great fan of NEDLACs, but it's a NEDLAC that focuses on keeping administrative prices down, given the kind of country we're living in, the kind of poverty that we're dealing with, and whether you'd be willing to be part of such an enterprise. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable James. Honourable Albert.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for a very comprehensive presentation. Your presentation is basically a fait accompli that has been presented to us, and my concern from a DTI point of view, but also from a South African economic point of view, is whether you have considered any other models that you have asked outside expertise from outside of ESCOM to contribute to building various models, options for the future, type of future thinking that from which you can make decisions as to what course you must take to ensure South Africa's energy sustainability. And based on your current position that you're in and your planning that you have, whether you have done any economic impact assessments from your side on South Africa's economy as a whole. Because I'm afraid if I look at the reactions from industry all across the country, there's going to be huge economic repercussions if the increases are granted. Given the fact also that you are trying to build a very strong balance sheet, one of the options I would like to ask whether you have considered looking at long-term debt instead of trying to impose higher rates from your customers. Then also just a last question, whether you've done, because you're forced to basically buy from IPPs on a certain rate by law, whether you have done any studies which you might have presented to the minister or to any of the authorities on when the IPPs, according to you, will become self-sustainable and will be able to compete properly so that some of the strain that is taken off of delivery of energy from ESCOM itself and which might lead us to a place where South Africa actually has competition in the market itself. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Albert. Before I forget, I only became aware now that Solga were here somewhere you know, just on the margins of this house. And we'd like to welcome both the head of electricity, and that is Mr. Zandile Mapumulo. Thank you very much, procurement and infrastructure there. And we also have from City Power, the managing director, Mr. Fikelo Zulu. Thank you very much, City of Johannesburg, of course. Thank you very much for being here. And of course, maybe very constructive, having heard what Eskom has said, and after their responses, most of the responses, I'd certainly like to hear your comment, at the very least, with respect to some of these rates, which you did make great reference to the cost and calculation thereof last week, I believe. But just as Eskom is responding to these issues that have come up, I think it's very pertinent to look back and see just what is the role of energy, and in this regard, as the biggest producer of that currently in our country, Eskom. What is its priority role in respect of our transformation of the economy, and in particular, decision of this government to prioritize the Industrial Policy Action Plan, in particular the instrument of manufacturing, to try to accelerate labor absorption and skilled employment in this regard. Now, exactly what role do you see Eskom playing? The ideas that come to mind, do we simply see this as another commodity input that we throw in? Or do we see it in a different light? Is it possible to see it in a different light? But one thing we have to recognize, you have emphasized the decision that you've got to keep Eskom in the black, as it were, manageable debt. On the other hand, we can't afford to lose our industrial base or in any way decelerate the program. So as you respond, if you would come through, you may not be able to come through immediately. You may need to come back either in writing or whatever. But thank you if you would now take the opportunity, Mr. Dalmers.
Chair, and thank you to the honourable members. I would not profess that we would be able to answer all the questions and be able to really give you solutions to all of this. So we will make some comments, and I will ask my colleagues to add to that. And Chair, if you allow us, we will come back in writing. I think the Honourable Fonamira raised quite a similar to your last question around really the essence around manufacturing our industrial base, and we have a role to play. You know, we have a role to make sure there's energy security in the country, and we do have a role to make sure we have a developmental role. I mean, Eskom has got a developmental role. It was created to make sure that all our people has got electricity. Initially only 30% of our people, today over 80%, but to industrialize South Africa. So we've also been trying to deal with this issue about how do you deal not only with low-income households, the issue of small business. So we have a role to make sure we create as much jobs in South Africa so that continues. And so the question is, if there's some interim relief, what can we do? We have raised this matter, and we have received comment, particularly from National Treasury, to say, you know, it's not your job as Eskom to go and say, where do you give specific relief? It's really the policymakers that needs to sit and say, we will support our manufacturing industry and we will provide whatever relief. I am aware that many other countries have taken that step. Many governments have taken the step to support some of the industries. So from our side, no, we've not specifically considered that. Yes, we are acutely aware of the impact of this. And Mohammed can maybe come to comment on the economic studies that we have done. We've done extensive economic studies. We've commissioned most economists in the countries to do that, and we can provide some answers for you in that regard. A lot of this said, you know, the industries should be competitive, and if we want to intervene, I think we should, as policymakers, make a decision and do that. Very difficult for us to decide, is it manufacturing, which part of manufacturing, and is it agriculture? And really, we would welcome at least that discussion to be had. And if guidance is given, then certainly we would follow the guidance from that perspective. The second part of the question is, the country should be growing faster. All our plans in Africa ask us to grow faster. We need to grow GDP close to 7% to create jobs in the country. We've come up with 1.9% by actually going to talk to every one of our customers and looking at every project they have planned for the next 5 years. And so we've done quite a bottom-up assessment of demand in the country, and we came up with 1.9. As I said, this year we've experienced minus 2.9% year-to-date for the first 6 months. Last year, only plus 0.2%. So very indicative of underlying growth, and we need to get the country going. So the question is, what do we then do if we suddenly have this? Our plans, our integrated resource plan, focuses on 3% electricity growth in the long term. So again, if that continues, we have to review our integrated resource plan. We have to build more power quickly. And then the energy efficiency is important. If we can really become more efficient, we can release that capacity for supporting our growth going forward. But we have come up with 1.9 from quite an extensive bottom-up assessment of customers. We have no customer, no mining company, no customer in South Africa that's got a project that Eskom has not given a quote for to say we'll connect it. We have about 5,000 megawatts of new projects in our pipeline for the next 10 years or so. And all of them has got a budget quote. All of them we have given them permission and quotes to connect them. And so that is where we come up with our estimate. Then the last question, and I'm going to ask my colleagues to comment on this first part, is our opinion around the electricity distribution. That's a very difficult question. I think, I can talk about my own view. I do think that customers in South Africa deserve equal treatment. Now, we have disparate tariffs in the country between what we charge, and it's a fundamental point, that's why I spend quite a bit of time, what we charge our customers is what is regulated by the regulator. So if somebody else charges a different tariff, it is decided by them. We can only charge what the regulator allows us to charge. We never apply our own discretion in that regard. So I do think the issue around tariff consistency throughout the country is important. How do we address the industrial policy issues? How do we address small business? I'm sure many of small business, maybe not supplied by us, but by municipalities or other suppliers. And so we need consistency around how that could be addressed. Our view is certainly that these issues cannot be left. There's also a massive investment required in upgrade. You know, we're building power stations, we're building transmission networks. It's 370 billion rand. We're spending 40 billion rand over the next 5 years in our own distribution, serving less than half of the country's consumers. And most of them has to be invested in. And so yes, the municipalities need to have revenues to invest in those infrastructures. But we do believe that the industry structure issues must be addressed. We have been talking about the fact that within metros, maybe the metros are more capacitated to take over that ownership. Eskom should maybe look at the rest of the country. That's one option. I believe that the maintenance of projects should maybe be looked at creating capacity where municipalities don't have, that at least you bring capacity together so that it can service and do the upgrades, do the refurbishment, do the maintenance, to assist the execution thereof. And maybe if you pull municipality capacity together amongst themselves to serve themselves, that will help. Because those are key issues as to how do you maintain these networks and deal with it. But we have, it's a long answer, and I'm not giving a direct answer, but we have to deal with it to get consistency around that. I don't know if my colleagues want to add on the first question.
Sure, we can certainly make available some of the work we have done on the economic impact studies. And what some of the studies looked at is in terms of sectors rather than particular companies and vulnerability in terms of reliance on electricity, so what is the input cost of electricity to the operations, and then ability to mitigate, in other words, to pass on the cost or get to energy efficiency. Now, this is where it becomes difficult, because some of the results we've seen, and I believe similar information was shared by the presentation from the Department of Public Enterprise, that says if you compare energy intensity in our economy at the moment with international benchmarks, there's a lot more space for energy efficiency. That's one area to cover. There are some other interesting factors where we looked, the studies looked at the demand for employment generally and where the demand is for unskilled labor, and there's a bit of a mismatch. So it concludes that if you look at the industries that have the higher demand for unskilled labor, they're actually the least energy intensive. What is clear, and I think this is where the committee's focus is clearly manufacturing and mining will be where there will be the most impact. Clearly there's impact in jobs. Now, this is the area where I think you need to get some of the experts into the room and decide what is the best path forward, because effectively what the studies are saying is if you look at short-term impacts, clearly there are negative indicators on various macroeconomic indicators. But you need to then counter that with the benefit of having electricity supply as we go into the future, and the benefit and the spin-off of the localization and industrialization that the actual build program is bringing into the country. That's the mitigating factor. To the extent that there are still vulnerable sectors and some sort of adverse impact, it's what Mr. Dalman referred to, and that is possibly the appropriate interventions are targeted interventions by government in specific sectors, but that choice is going to have to be with government. We've had discussions with energy intensive users group. We've had discussions with a number of business sectors as well. Some of the questions we have had not had answered is, for example, what has happened to the benefit of low-cost electricity prices for the last 2 decades? What has that done for their competitiveness in the sectors they do operate in? The second question that we have not got clear answers on is electricity the problem? So if we solve this, and if we find a way to solve it, is that the problem solved? And the answer generally has been no. And there's a list of another 8 factors that come into play in terms of what's affecting us, in terms of competitiveness as a country. Our view that when you put all of this together, it clearly the approach around a targeted approach is much more optimal than a shotgun approach. It says every user, let's just reduce the cost of supply because there's a subsidy in the system in that way. We also believe, as the IPAC has started doing, is that with targeted interventions, you can link it to criteria and key targets that need to be met over a period so you don't continually get to where we were before. All of you will be aware, honourable members, at the moment we are criticised for the BHP listing contracts in terms of the special pricing. And some of what we're talking about is, again, going back to repeat the mistakes of the past.
Paul wanted to make that point, so I'll move on to the next question. Honourable McIntosh raised a question. I do apologise. I did not put where South Africa is. As I've indicated when I presented on the duration index, we're currently at 43 hours, so we're way above, and we can give you exactly for different customers, how fair. Our networks are totally different. In many countries, people have a redundant supply to customers, and we don't have it yet. And on the next one, I think we're at 23 in terms of safety. But if you look at our annual 6-monthly report, it's actually in there, and you can find it. Then there's a question around VGB, China, US, why Eurocentric? We are a member of the VGB, and so the data that we compare are comparable. We can get the U.S. information. We certainly do that for our nuclear plant in terms of the U.S. And we have not seen any specific data around China in terms of availability, but we can get that as far as the performance are concerned. Then you ask quite an important question around the feasibility of Eskom supplying local authorities. I think we've dealt with that. It really has to be, it's technically feasible and there's a joint agreement. I have received requests and we have worked together with municipalities where we asked to find solutions for companies to connect them and supply them. But we have to have a greater look at that because it has an impact on the business model for the municipality. Then the question around local procurement and IDPs and solar panels and PVs. Let me first start with local procurement around solar panels, solar water geysers. We have decided to move away from the rebate system for solar water geysers and actually start contracting, and we're working very closely with the IDC to now contract directly with manufacturers so that we can intensify localization of them. IDC will support, we contract them directly for volumes and so that we can have South African manufacturer solar water geysers. So we have changed the model. We already, in terms of our rebates, have skewed it to give greater rebates for local manufacturers solar water geysers. The next step is contract with the manufacturers, given certainty, IDC will support, and then we have the manufacturers in South Africa. Then you ask a question about the IPPs, which is down to contract. I mean, the country, in terms of this plan, will enter into 3,700 megawatts of solar PV, wind farms, and all of that. But we're not part of the procurement. We've signed the contracts at the end. I'm not too sure of what the localization effort is there. I mean, my colleagues have it, my mom has it, so you can give you a sense. But it is a very important issue because essentially the South African consumer will subsidize this, as we said, through the tariff. And most of the funding comes from South African institutions as well. And so we have to make sure. If I had my wish, I would have only allowed African companies to do the IPP work, private companies, out of Eskom, in order to make sure that this stays in the country. But I think Mohammed can maybe talk about the localization component of the IPPs.
Chigola wanted to indicate, I don't have the details, but as part of the procurement process run by the Department of Energy, they have brought in issues around localization, equity, transformation in the assessment of the bids that were proposed.
Then there was a question from the Honourable Member around, I think, the IPP process versus Eskom. We have given that. We only charge what NERSA allows us to charge. So if a Munich charges less, we can't drop it because NERSA regulates the tariffs we can charge. So again, it goes to the fundamental right. NERSA regulates Eskom, and municipalities have a constitutional right to supply and set prices. And so that's the difference between the two. So really, whatever we charge our customers is what NERSA has provided. I think on IPP prices, Eskom prices, we have given some indication. There was a question around, are there any funding, further funding available through the PICC work to Eskom? The response that we have from government is that the support that we have received, 60 billion subordinated loan, the 350 guarantees, that is it. There's no further support in terms of equity forthcoming for Eskom in terms of equity investments. I think you can talk about Kusile and Madupi days.
Yeah, Madupi, Kusile and Gula, we've been pretty consistent since for the last 2.5 years on completion. The first unit of Madupi will come online next year. The units thereafter are 6 months apart. Kusile will come at the end of 2014 and 8 months apart. And the reason for the 8 months is as part of our funding solution, we actually stretched out Kusile. And in Gula, all the four units toward the end of 2014. So the build program is on track. It's very challenging and very difficult, but at this stage we are quietly confident we can make the dates, given all the risks that surround something of this nature.
To the question from Honourable James, will we be willing to look at this administrative pricing caucus? Certainly, from Eskom, certainly. We would actively participate. We have engaged NetLec previously. We again do that. And any other thing that is arranged or set up, we will definitely be willing to participate. To Honourable Alberts, there were some questions. Any outside thinking as to how we solve the problem? I'll get Paul to give you the detail, but let me just say a few words. When we did the funding for Eskom, we did extensive outside work. I mentioned credits. We've got all the global banks to work with us to try and find a solution. And we're quite happy to make that available to you. You can see the work and look at the solutions. The economic impact assessments, yes, we've done it. We've had most universities working with us. Again, we can give you all of those reports that they have prepared. We have done the economic impact assessments, so we can make that available. Long-term debt, yes, 60% of our debt is longer than 10 years. We have long-term debt. That's what we do. We try and match long-term assets, long-term debt, in order to make sure that the rates are lower and we can match the asset versus the debt. So we are actively pursuing long-term debt from that perspective. And then maybe, Paul, you can have the detail.
Just briefly, from a financial sustainability, 45 options we considered that we took through government in 2010 was, firstly, can we sell shares in Eskom? No. Can we sell assets of Eskom? It wasn't feasible and the return's quite high. And we can sell 100% of the assets. And so when we went down all the structures we came in, we then benchmarked ourselves against fellow utilities. And we have secured 80% of the 300 billion funding plan. And we've done it through local bonds. We've done it through international bonds. We've done it through export credits. We've done it through development funding institutions. We've got the largest World Bank loan ever granted to a single institution. We've got African Development Bank loan. We've got Development Bank of South Africa loans. Large amount of export credits and continue to look for other options. So we believe we're quite diverse. We do try and stretch the debt out as long as possible, but it gets very expensive the further you go out. And we do worry, as I said, is that today we have debt that matures in 2042. We're struggling to maintain these assets. So, you know, these are the concerns we look at. But we're always open to ideas and we get a lot of input in that.
The latest piece of work we've done is, I think, with Citibank, to say, how would you fund expansion beyond what we currently pursue? And there's very interesting work as to the level of funding you can raise, the equity you would need, and what you can actually afford, whether Eskom or the country. You know, so again, the studies are there, we have it available, and certainly will make it available. Chair, on your question, I think we do need to spend some quality time thinking through that and respond to you around the role of Eskom. We have a role to play in terms of industrial job creation and presently manufacturing industry, but also to make sure it's viable. But I must say, from our side, we would like to see greater leadership from policy perspective so that these choices can be made. Thank you, Chair.
Right. I think, members, I know that many questions have not been asked. Did you want just to come back on something, Honourable Hilders? Did I? Yes, and then you got lost in the crowd. Thank you.
Difficult to lose me in a crowd, but... yes. Mr. Damas, I just wanted to ask about, I think it was yesterday, that you announced the intention of your colleague, the CFO, whose name escapes me right now, I apologize. Flaherty, that's right. His intention to leave Eskom in the middle of 2013, I think it was. Now, I mean, you know, that's obviously a concern as well, because he is a pivotal management figure, and so I just wanted you to tell us a little bit more about that, please.
I'm trying to just relate it to the core point of our public hearings. I take it you feel that this will have a direct impact.
Well,
let me deal with that. I mean, we've been quite clear with this, and he can talk for himself. We're more than colleagues. I mean, we've actually become good friends. We've actually been quite a good team. It's a big loss for Eskom. When Paul came in, we had very set things that we needed to do. We needed to solve the funding issues. We needed to put Eskom, deal with some of the issues that we've had, make sure Eskom is on a different level. We set ourselves out to achieve and set up an organization that is world-class in terms of power performance. So hence all the benchmarks that we do, financial systems. And he's come to the point where he said, listen, I'd like to take on some new challenges to deal with. It's a big loss for Eskom. Between certainly the shareholder, the board of Eskom, the executive, none of us would love to see this seem leave for that matter. I've worked quite hard to make sure that is the case. We've planned, we have a plan in place in terms of succession at Eskom for all our critical positions. So we're implementing that plan. We've announced it yesterday. Paul will remain until the AGM, and we will have by then now start the implementation of our succession plan. We'll find somebody to head up the vault, we'll find somebody to head up financial area, and Paul will remain, see through the MIP process, the financial results, natural succession plan that will see its conclusion at the AGM. We've planned this, we will manage it as a company, that's my responsibility, and we will do that. It's very important to note that we have, most probably, outside of National Treasury, the largest and biggest and strongest treasury in the country. And so our treasury team is the ones that really runs our funding, and within that, great stability, very good skills, and there's no change there. Within our build program, we set up a construction management team. Management is in place. All the projects are in place. People are in place, and the leadership remains in place. And really, this is part of our succession process. We have it in place. I'm now implementing that. We've announced it, been very transparent. Other than the fact that I make a joke of it, that he supports the Lions, other than that, we're great friends.
Well, yes, I'm sure it will be, though, an initial loss, notwithstanding measures that may be in place. Just before we conclude, with the Eskom issues themselves, I wanted, while you were here on the floor before I closed you off, just let us get some comment from Solga, because you were here last week and are not in a position as to say what you may have said and what you didn't say. But clearly, whatever you said was very memorable to members who felt they ought to be tackling other issues here with Eskom as well. You've heard the responses to most of the questions we faced, and You were indicating that there'd been a misunderstanding on the committee part with respect to perhaps summer rates with municipalities, and no one was on a flyer that you were not aware of. It was our misunderstanding. Am I correct in that? Yes.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and honourable members as well. And probably just to thank ESCOM as well for the insightful, I think, presentation, very informative. Honourable Chair, I think last week we came as a South delegation led by the Ms. Director for Infrastructure at FALCA, Tubeli, who basically led discussions. And I'd probably like to just emphasize some of the points that were raised at a high level, and my colleague will also come in, I think, in terms of the input. I think probably the first point, Madam Chair, that we raised was probably at SALGA, we were also concerned about the escalating costs in terms of electricity. And I think we share the same sentiments in terms of the, you know, the committee's concerns around the impact in terms of the economic development, not, you know, of the country. However, just to clear some of the misconception in terms of the municipal setting of tariffs rates, we also not immune to regulation, just like ESCOM. What happens is the municipalities are regulated as well by NERSA, and there are a set of guidelines that we need to comply with in terms of setting our tariffs. And those have to take into consideration the input cost from the bulk purchases from ESCOM, which accounts about 70% of, on average, of the total cost of delivering electricity to the, you know, to the customers by municipality. And then what then happens is the balance of the 30% of the total cost, then that will then go to the interest charges for the municipalities to be able to invest back into the infrastructure. And then secondly, there has to be a portion as well for the repairs and maintenance, for the maintenance of the infrastructure, and also to cover some of the, you know, the salaries and other costs. So in actual fact, if you look at the total cost of delivering supply to the customers, we then have to consider the ESCOM increase. I mean, as I've mentioned that the municipalities will see an impact of about 13%. So it means then that our costs from the, you know, the municipality point of view, there will then be an impact of the 70% of that portion by the 13% that we're looking at. And unfortunately, that may, of course, we have to also pass it through to the customer. So I think it's therefore not that municipality will just raise the tariffs without any guidelines. We're basically guided by that particular process. And I think in terms of the benchmarking process that we've looked at, municipalities comply with the guidelines from NERSA. I think that's probably one point that I would like to, you know, to raise. But just as an illustration, you know, for the ease of reference and probably for ease of understanding of the members, we actually made a point of the, you know, this financial year's increase, and we made an illustration with the Etegwini municipality, for instance, where they actually got an increase of about 11%. And out of the 11% total increase, obviously granted by NERSA, the 8.6% of that total 11% was as a result of the pass-through cost from the bulk purchases. And only the balance was obviously the increase that accounts to us, to the municipalities. And I think that's just the high-level point that I would like to highlight and share.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mapumelo.
Mr. Kulu.
Right. Mr. Kulu.
Okay, Chairperson, now is Sandile Maphumulo from Ethekwini Municipality, but today wearing the SALGA hat. There was an issue that was raised, which related to Tswane raising its tariffs by 700%. And it's unfortunate that some of the members were not there last week when that was clarified. And that was looking at one component of the tariff structure for a particular company. Because as ESCOM indicated earlier on, is that their revenue requirements and their tariff increases are driven by the cost elements. Eskom indicated that its major cost element is the input cost, which is coal. And for us, the major cost component is in terms of the maintenance of the network. And which is what then, when, let's say, Tswane decides that in terms of the demand charges, they are going to put it up by so much. And in terms of the energy charges, what has not come out in the media is that Tswane's energy charges is probably less than what sometimes they are paying Eskom. That is what came up very clear in terms of the presentations that were made last week. And for us then, I would like if the members can be able to get the presentation that was done by Salka last week, and if they go to page 13 of that presentation, when they get it, they will then find that that was whatever we were talking about. We made an illustration with two balls, and those balls had some nucleus in within them, and that was the size that differed from the from Eskom's tariffs and the municipal tariffs. I remember when Mr. Kulu was trying to clarify stuff, was that it's almost like you are selling bread. If you are buying bread from the bakery, the bakery can sell you bread at 8 rand for the, or 2 rand for the bread and 8 rand for the package. But when you buy it and you sell it through and you have got some better way of procuring the packaging, you can then sell the bread for 8 rand and then the packaging for 2 rand. But at the end of the day, it's the same, which is what the media hype has been about. Tswane's tariffs have not been pushed up by the 700% that is suggested. And I hope that that myth has been addressed, and if we go through all those presentations, we are going to confirm that. And as we indicated, the major cost for the municipality, just to re-emphasize Mr. Kulu's point, is that this much is our input cost, which is buying the energy, and we cannot do anything with that other than passing it through. And then the municipalities are this much. As we indicated, the tailwind is 2.4% compared to 8.6% of the total 11% that we were having. And it is the same with all the other municipalities when you look at the basket of service that we are providing to the customers. Because there are two elements. It's energy element and it's a demand element. And when you then combine those two, there's very little difference between the two. And if we then go, if when we get here, yeah, exactly, yeah, so that's fine. And when we go to it, you'll find that we indicated that between Eskom and the municipality for the same customers, we may have a difference of 1 cent. And one of the things, Chairperson, that must be taken into consideration is that municipalities are also subsidizing Eskom's residential customers. And that then forms part of the cost that we have to do. But, Chairperson, we do not want to have the floor. It wasn't our presentation, but we thought that, and we appreciate that the Chair and the Committee gave us the opportunity to make this clarification. But also we'll be irresponsible if we do not also thank the neutral way in which Eskom responded to these questions. Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much. And that is Salgaden, Mr. Mapu Mulu. Okay, sorry. And the other one is Mr. Pulu from City Power. actually, when I left here, we were thinking of the Eastern Cape. I live in Johannesburg, which is quite far from the Eastern Cape, and we were looking at Buffalo City as figures, among others. Those were the figures we were looking at. I'm well aware of Swanee's figures and Johannesburg, although I think residentially I'd probably pay most. Yes, Mr. McIntosh.
Madam Chair, my concern is in Eskom's presentation, they make the point that in keeping with electricity regulation, which also applies to SALGA, Eskom is allowed to recover its costs provided that they are efficiently and prudently incurred and to make a reasonable return. Now, with in my view, Eskom has made a good case that it is, in fact, efficiently and prudently incurring these costs. Maybe if I was doing a due diligence, I might come to another opinion, but I'm certainly convinced that they are doing that, and they are entitled to make a reasonable return, because if we don't make a return, we're going to kill them. So, but I'm not convinced that SALGA is also, and certainly some of its municipality members, are being efficiently and prudently run. And Madam Chair, I think that's our concern. And I think the SALGA members must understand that we represent manufacturing and industry, and one of our concerns is that South Africa, apart from the competition we get from Asia and other countries, we are deindustrializing as a country, or, well, not quite, that's perhaps a bit dramatic, but we are definitely seeing reduced level of investment in manufacturing. Now, one of the reasons people invested a lot in this country, and that was the answer to Mr. Mohammed's one question, is that our energy was so inexpensive. So if you're asking what return did those guys get on cheap energy, we brought manufacturing into this country. And all of that has a spin-off effect. But to get back to Mr. Kulu and Mapumula, who come from two of the biggest metros in the country, certainly City Power, I think has a budget bigger than Zimbabwe, if you ask me. But the point is that these two gentlemen, with their SALGA hats on, the evidence we had, and it was here in the thing, in Velco, they'd be seriously affected. I mean, there seems to be a municipality which is a banana republic. It's certainly not a new South African municipality. In my area, a big global investment group like Nestle, who make all our coffee, they are building another 2 or 3 billion, planning to invest it. But because the local authority is just adding to their electricity costs, and I don't know, Madam Chair, so I'll get a specific case, that is going to, they are seriously reconsidering those investments. And you know, they're not some Mickey Mouse company. They invest in Indonesia, in Argentina, everywhere else. So if we're going to want to be in the game globally and in BRICS, we've got to get there. And SALGA has to play its part, man. And then the last question I've got is, I had a letter from an organisation called Property Owners and Managing Agents in Johannesburg, the centre city. They have 80,000 flats amongst their members. And that's about 250,000 people live in those 80,000 flats. I mean, the City Power's additions, I'm not now even talking about their billing, chamosh is about the best word to use, I think. I don't know if the Zulu guys understand chamosh, but it's a mess. And I think they're trying to address that. But really, our Madam Chair is a victim too, because she lives in the City Power domain. The impact on those 80,000 flats, because each individual flat owner, or at least flat occupier, has to pay their own electricity, has been enormous. And I tell them to tell us, and my last question, because this is an Eskom presentation, Madam Chair, SALGA must tell us, how sympathetic are they to Eskom supplying directly to manufacturers and job creators in the municipalities? such as, for example, has happened in Maltina in the northeastern Cape?
I think that sort of question was raised, and that's why the constitutional aspect was pointed out, that while they may, it still has to be the municipalities who give the green light, as we understand it. But you're right, that's a very important point, and it's going to take me to the end of, when we come to the end, which is going to be after Honourable Mabasa.
Thanks, Comrade Chair. My question is to Eskom, to what degree is economies of scale a positive factor in what Eskom recovers, I mean financially, compared to if we didn't have that? But then the second question is, noting that we have to deal with policy issues as government, but noting that we are faced with this dilemma between Eskom and the municipalities, actually, yeah, between Eskom, I'm missing the term here, but between the various municipalities and Eskom, what solutions are suggested, whether by Eskom or whether by SALGA, so that where there are inefficiencies, suggestions come forth to assist municipalities, because municipalities are not of the same strength, you know, in many regards. Thanks.
Right. We don't have time for the responses right now. But what I am going to say, I think, is going to be an avenue, a channel that will enable us to take this further. Because the very point that the Honourable Mabasa has raised now, and that we have just closed the questions and comments on, has been, I think, taking us to the point that we agreed on 2 weeks ago, when we began to see more of the complexities arising, that there is no way we're going to be able to conclude and to reach a position on the matter now. We do need a preliminary one. So what was informally agreed, as it were, was the idea of a colloquium, which I'm sure was raised even in Edcombe's presence at one point, in which we would invite NERSA, we would invite Eskom. I'm looking at the list I've got here. Obviously, we would invite SALGA. And, you know, we thought of inviting what could be called key meaning the cost difference, the gap. Certain municipalities, and may well consider that over and above SALGA, National Treasury, DPE, and energy, you know, the Department of Energy, among others, along. So we would invite about 7 or 8 people from the manufacturing as well, not to a one day. We can't do, you can see how long we've engaged with Eskom, and we haven't even really got down to it. What we've had is an introductory approach to the matter, which is just enabled us to get a footing, as it were. And that's what these public hearings have done. They've alerted us to the fact that while on the one hand we want IPAC to move, everyone in the country does, we want manufacturing to grow, and it was reported just before the public hearings that over 300 companies, am I right, I should have welcomed you there, Mr. John Phillips, from DTI, Industrial Policy Division, had closed down in the Eastern Cape. Small manufacturing, we can't continue on this hemorrhage. We just can't. And all listed, rightly or wrongly, energy, you know, the cost of Eskom. Now, we haven't been able, of course, to look and verify that. So we thought that was one of the key reasons why we've tried to focus more and more on this. But more information we get, the more we engage with stakeholders, such as yourselves, Eskom, you've put a different picture on things. You've almost fleshed up, you know, the charcoal itching, as it were. Much flinner. In the same breath, we have Solga maintaining certainly not municipalities individually who are doing this, and yet we have such solid information that the gap, not between with all, let me make that clear, and certainly the city of Pwani and Johannesburg did not come up. It was Buffalo City and Bloemfontein. What's that one in Bloemfontein? And Nelson Mandela Bay and the one in the Free State? Welcome. Yes, it can't be that free. Now, judging from that electricity price, but we have these different companies come up. So one of our members here, but we all latched onto it and claimed it as our own idea, but one of our members, Honourable Mena Merva, in passing in one of her comments and so on, seemed to think it would be a good idea, and we all began to agree on that, for us to get round a table where you're all there at the same time looking for some sort of solution, one that is sustainable for everyone. We can't go backwards, as you say. And you made that very clear, Mr. O'Flaherty, that that would not be the solution to where we were going. The CEO, Mr. Dahmer, emphasized that again in the overview. And so we certainly, I learned from my union background, the moment you start talking of colloquiums, negotiations, it means we're all going to slightly shift our position, no matter what. But it will have to remain a constructive platform and resolution in the country's interest, but also the people's interest as a whole. So we are proposing at this point to utilize the week of the 28th of January. Perhaps not on that exact Monday, but we're looking at least 3 days in which a program would be drawn up in December, sent out in the hopefully pretty soon, getting people on board, so that you can also look at your diaries, which are arranged sometimes 3 months, 6 months ahead, international dates and so on, and that you can make yourselves available. But meanwhile, we do need to finish a preliminary report. And that preliminary report will indicate what I have just said, that we are not in a position to finalize our report in this area. We haven't even touched on the beneficiation that has been impacted on and so on. And that we will need to do that in the new year. So the reason why I wanted to make sure all the parties were represented as we took this position, it is a firm position and a proposal that I'm making that we take forward to 2013. So I look at the committee as I say this in front of some of the stakeholders. We don't have any objections, I see. Right, so we can move with it. So the principle has been adopted. We will make sure you get a preliminary report, which we will be obliged to file next week, on where we are, as it were, and what we intend, what kind of outcome I believe we're all looking for. But having said that, I must thank you and your team, in particular Mr. Brian Dallas from Eskom. You've given us a very solid and sound presentation that has taken us forward. So this is a good time to close off 2012. We still have a lot of questions that they may not answered for whatever reason, and we hope to share some of this with you as outstanding issues we believe we may be able to tackle in the colloquium itself. So thank you to Eskom and the team for being here. Thank you to Solga. Thank you also to DTI, Mr. Flitz, for being here as well. To the members, we badly put on the idea of minutes. I look to see if there may not be possible to do 2 quick minutes and 5 minutes. No, well, Mr. Hermans was not as optimistic as I was, so he never brought any. So, saved by the gong. On that note, let's look at the next meeting. The next meeting then will be next week, Wednesday, at 9 o'clock. a full day. It says 1230 still, it should be 1300. Every kind of labeling issue you can think of, GMOs, wrongful labeling, the biocide, the GMOs, all of that will be here, and the conclusion of the minutes. Yes, Honourable Khadiri?
Chairperson, when looking at this program, it's a good program that we end up by the 29th. But there was this request from BASA, the CEO of BASA, to come and see us as a management, because it was the issue. Yeah, so I'll prefer a management committee, if it could be done, because from the 27th, I think he's going on leave. They've got meeting, something of that nature. If we can schedule something before that, before Tuesday. So I think that part will deal with it after this thing, but I just wanted to put it on the court.
Chair.
Take that forward. Yes, Honourable Hill-Lewis?
The unsecured lending issue is something that's very close to the heart of everyone on this committee. Why should BASA not come and address the full committee?
In fact, it's not why they should not. It's really to do with members' time, not BASA at all. I must make that clear. You know, at this stage, we can't shift the Wednesday meeting. You know what's on Wednesday, okay? We have got Thursday, I am aware, and they're not here after Tuesday. Am I correct? Tuesday the 27th. So the only time you'd have available, quite frankly, and let's be clear on this, would be Friday morning. That's the only time available.
But Chair, the constituency week only starts the following week on the 10th.
Explained about BASA, they're not here after the 27th. We can deal with, you know, so allow me to deal with the detail here. Take the point, because I would agree unsecured lending is important. It is very important. Let me just get one more comment on that. Honourable Khadebe.
Thank you, Chairperson. As I said, that ideally it would help in the committee, but looking at the problem is difficult. But if the members are open for a Friday meeting, this coming Friday meeting, it will be fine. We can invite BASA for Friday meeting and then we finish it off.
Well, one at a time. You can't just walk out as 20 or 10. We're in the middle of a meeting. Quietly. Yes. Honourable Gentlemen.
Chair, why can't we let the management committee set an agenda for the BASA thing and then schedule it after that? Because we've seen BASA on this matter, and I don't know what it is that they're going to come and discuss with us.
They were originally on, actually, this is the thing, and we were meeting on Friday. It was, we, you know, thought with the committee having had such a heavy year, we may take it off. But of course, that was more a human, informed by a human understanding, rather than a strategic one. Honourable Khadebe?
Chairperson, as one thing, I understand what Honourable Hill-Lewis is raising on the other side. What we could do, let's say, if it is possible for us to meet on Friday, it would be ideal. But if it is not, let's say we schedule a management for Friday, invite any other member who wants to attend. But as you said correctly, said that, let's put it at your able hands that would resolve that before the 27th. We have that meeting.
Resolving it right now, because the reality is Friday is 2 days away. So we will meet on Friday, but we will also complete minutes on Friday as well. So let us be here. If we even have a program, we could do that. We'll try to pick up a lot of work this Friday, what we can. What we can't goes forward to the 29th. Are we in order? So we will do unsecured lending. Whether or not BASA will be here will be up to them to make themselves available. We will certainly invite them. right. I see the good sign coming from the bottom there, a positive one. Thank you very much, Honourable Hill Lewis. Members, we wanted to, you've had a very heavy year, and we're not sure on the 29th just how long the IP is going to take. We will have, we believe, a response back from Parliament's legal advisers on Friday. But perhaps even there on that day we would be able to plan ahead. So we don't know if it's going to be a short process or a long process. I have no idea as I sit here. But we will make that an urgent request to have that meeting Friday. One would like to ask members, if you're planning on leaving early at 12, and all your travel arrangements, when is your conference, Honourable Hill Lewis?
Beginning Friday morning.
Here we are, you'll have to just excuse yourself from registration, and then make yourself available. And you'll, yeah, and I think it will be wise to inform your leadership that this is a matter of grave importance and that your registration will have to wait till the afternoon. Thank you. Right. Members, the meeting is adjourned until next.